Welcome to the Health and Human Services Finance Omnibus Conference Committee. We are going to call the meeting to order and begin today. Today we're going to be discussing two programs, our MNSURE program and Minnesota Care program. The areas of probably the biggest policy difference between the House and the Senate in our omnibus bills, and we want to make sure that members understand exactly what the policy decisions are in terms of the Senate positions and priorities, and the House position priorities, and the governor, as well as the differences, and primarily focusing on program fiscal integrity and sustainability moving forward. What I'd like to do is to begin with MNSURE today. And discuss that as well and take member questions on that, and then go to Minnesota Care. We have Ms. O'Toole and Mr. Lights. Welcome to the committee. And what I would like to do, just perhaps since obviously been some news, and Ms. O'Toole, congratulations on your appointment, and I look forward to meeting and working with you. But just to kind of give us a brief update of where things are and how we're situated moving forward, an update basically for the committee, and what the policy directives are in the leadership decisions by the governor and the agency moving forward. So with that, if you'd like to make some introductory comments and just a basic update, we'd want to move to that first. And Senator Laurie.
I just want to be a popular guy. I thought I would announce at the front end, we're not going to be meeting on Saturday.
Yay.
See, that's a good way to get a meeting started, right?
We'll have the gavel on Sunday and we'll be meeting. Happy Mother's Day in advance to all the moms out there. Ms. O'Toole, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I'm here with Scott Lights, who is the current CEO, and I will turn it to him to begin with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. For the record, I'm Scott Lights. I'm the CEO at MNSURE. We concluded, Mr. Chair, our open enrollment period back in February and enrolled around 60,000 individuals in qualified health plans, and since that time, we've been spending the majority of our time working with our partners at the Department of Human Services and at Minute Services, really planning out the continued build-out of the shared eligibility and enrollment system that's commonly referred to as MNSURE, getting ready for fall open enrollment, which begins in November of this coming year. We have a pathway to add a fair amount of additional functionality to the system that is necessary over the course of the coming months. As members of the conference committee know, it was a more successful open enrollment period in terms of the consumer-facing side of the MNSURE system. Folks had relative ease in getting enrolled in the system this year, but there remain some challenges that we know we need to address for the coming open enrollment period. Many of those are related to the back-end side of the system, and so Minute Services is taking the lead on working with the vendors and staff at Minute to build out those additional pieces related to adding functionality for change in circumstance, or what's commonly known as life event, adding the ability for brokers and navigators and counties to work more directly in the system than they're able to do today, and additional functionality additions that will ease things like Minnesota Care payment processing and other pieces that are necessary to continue to make the system function as well as it can. We'll also be finalizing plans to focus our outreach and enrollment around ensuring that we have good broad coverage. We were able to, over the first open enrollment period, reduce the level of uninsured collectively by over 40%. We're certainly hopeful that the second open enrollment period, continue to reduce the uninsurance rate, and our focus moving into year three will continue to be on focusing on ensuring that folks, if they're eligible for Medicaid, if they're eligible for Minnesota Care, or if they're eligible for qualified tax credits for qualified health plans, whether with or without a tax credit, are able to get into coverage, as our main focus continues to be ensuring that Minnesotans do get into the health insurance coverage that's required. The final thing I'll just say, Mr. Chair, is that as we're looking internal to the organization, we continue to focus on ensuring that we're doing our operations as effectively and efficiently as possible. We had a much smoother second year, for example, in our contact center, but we're now going to be focusing on improving the quality of customer service that goes into the contact center and ensuring that not only are folks' calls getting answered rapidly, but that their questions are getting answered promptly, and that the coordination between staff at MNSHARE and staff at the Department of Human Services is as seamless as possible, and that's something we continue to work out as well.
Thank you, Mr. Lights. Welcome to the committee. Ms. O'Toole, would you like to make any opening comments or statements to the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Allison O'Toole, currently the Deputy Director for External Affairs, incoming interim CEO, and I appreciate the opportunity here today. Look forward to working with all of you. I think, as you heard earlier this week, we intend this to be a very smooth transition. I've been working with Mr. Lights for the last 15 months, so on the external side, and really support and have learned the direction of the organization. I expect that to continue, and happy to answer any questions you may have today.
Thank you, Ms. O'Toole. And questions, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Lights and Ms. O'Toole. As we kind of look at the various proposals in front of us, and as we will navigate in this committee and in the upcoming week, the direction that we go with MNSHARE, I have a couple of questions. I understand that the board is not officially endorsing any given proposal before the legislature, but I guess your feedback on a couple of different pieces, and I guess I would specifically be speaking to House File 5, and I could go through a couple different pieces, but I guess maybe I just first ask, is there anything... Are there pieces that you think are a particularly good direction for us to move in as policymakers when it comes to the functionality of MNSHARE, or anything that brings particular concern to how MNSHARE functions and going forward?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, if you could maybe mention a few of the specific provisions you might have an interest in, I'd be happy to try to respond to those.
Okay, sure. Mr. Chair and Mr. Lights, I guess a couple of the pieces, one thing that brought a fair amount of consternation 2 years ago when MNSHARE came into existence was some of the exemptions that were created for MNSHARE, and understanding some of those were due to the tight timeline in trying to create MNSHARE, but others that I think were probably an overreach and not necessary in terms of some of the open meeting laws exemptions, procurement process exemptions, administrative oversight exemptions. And so, one thing House File 5 aims to do is to bring MNSHARE more in line with what is expected of other agencies. And I'm just wondering your feedback. Do you see that as a hindrance to the way MNSHARE needs to function? Do you see that as a better way of moving forward? Do you have any feedback on those exemptions that MNSHARE has existed with and moving forward?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, thank you. You're absolutely right. I think some of those provisions were originally put in because of the tight timelines that were in front of us and the need to move rapidly on some things. Generally speaking, I would say as a general rule, we've tended to follow the open procurement or the procurement laws in the state anyway. And so I think in general, some of the exemptions that were added on the IT procurement side, for example, I have limited concern that those would that taking those away would really cause us any huge problems, because I think by and large we've followed those laws. I think that the there are certain provisions that have allowed for personnel matters, for example, to have closed sessions of the board, for example, to deal with personnel issues. Those are things that would typically be closed within state government as well. So I think consistency on those pieces, I think, is important so that we're able to deal with personnel issues with the board in a manner that's off from from the public side, but I do think in general we would have limited concerns about some of the other, like the exemptions on, around procurement and some other things.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, and
No, just real quick, Mr. Chair, and for context, I think the Senate is in line as well with getting rid of most of the exemptions. And so I think we can, it's one of the areas that there will be a good deal of agreement.
Sure. And to that, and we can maybe continue to talk, and maybe I could get clarification. There were a couple still, I think, in the Senate proposal that involved some of the procurement exemptions and some of the administrative oversight exemptions, but maybe clarity on what exactly that means going forward. But as I read back through and listen to some of the auditor's report and the interviews that were done, looking back at that process and the decision to have exemptions for procurement, there was a lot of concern raised at the time by the commissioner of Minute at the time that not being a wise way to move forward. He was overridden in that decision-making process with that exemption going forward on procurement. So I would just be interested to know why we would continue to need to have that exemption when there was such concern originally 2 years ago and then continuing that forward. So that would just be one question. But I guess one of the other pieces I was curious about was in House File 5, there's a couple of things trying to provide a better experience for the consumer and make sure that we're doing as much as we can. And two of those pieces are, one, how quickly, once Minsure has a submitted application and somebody's gone through the process of Minsure, how quickly that information can get to the plans. And I realize that some of this relates to some of the IT hang-up, but I guess there's some language in House File 5 that would put how quickly that needs to get to the plans, and I would love your feedback on that. And then the other piece that I think is really trying to make sure that we're doing better by the citizens is what is already required in federal law, and that is that the tax credit be divisible by household. My understanding is that this time that's not allowed or possible, and I'm wondering, it is federal law, I'm wondering if there is a process or a plan to get in line with federal law to make sure that tax credit can be divisible for families that need it to be.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, let me start with your first question, which really relates to the transfer of information from Minsure to the health plans. And there's sort of two pieces to this. I think right now the transfer of information does occur to the health plans. I think the challenging part and the frustrating part that has been there for the plans is that it hasn't been in an electronically data interchanged fashion, meaning that the system itself doesn't flow electronic to electronic in the way that it should. And when I talked a little bit about the build-out, that is a piece of functionality that we do anticipate having up and running. I'm not sure if I have it here on my chart, but it's one I know that's a top priority for us to get running. And what was the case last year was that we were able to actually have that running. We, for year two, put in place an enrollment system of record, which was a very, very important thing to add, but it also set us back a little bit on the transfer of the 834 files and that process. We are now able to pivot and actually get that done. So I don't have any major concerns about those that specific. I don't have the language that you're talking about specifically in front of me, but the general concept that we should be able to get that information on a very reasonable timeline to the health plans electronically is one that I wouldn't at all disagree with, and I think is one that's important. As to the tax divisibility piece, I'm going to look to Katie and just could you give me just a second on this one?
Sure.
Because I think part of the issue here has been the system build out and our ability to actually do that piece of work. So let me just, if you wouldn't mind, Katie, talking a little bit about that piece, if you have a moment.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Katie Burns, Chief Operating Officer at Minsure. Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, you are correct that the ability to divide the advanced premium tax credit among different members of a household that are choosing different plans is a federal requirement. It is something that, although it is a federal requirement, it is a complex one to build into the IT system and is not something that we've been able to do to date. It is something that we can do. It will require significant IT resources. We just acknowledge that that we're working on a number of IT issues as we have been in communication about, and so we would have some concern that it anything new that we're trying to do, require some resources that we're using to address some critical county and health insurance company priorities. So just looking to strike a balance there.
And Mr. Chair, and just on a follow-up, does the federal exchange allow for the tax to be divisible by household?
Ms. Burns.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, certainly the federal exchange is, of course, operating under the same requirements. I believe that the federal exchange is able to do that at this time.
Senator Lurie.
On that item, is it included in our blueprint that it will be done, or have you worked with the feds, and are they comfortable with the fact that this is something, an added functionality that will be added at a later date? As we put it in our priority list?
Mr. Chair and Senator Lurie, certainly our federal partners are aware that we are still working on the completion of the IT build, and they have not raised this issue specifically to us as a concern.
Thank you, Ms. Burns. Representative May.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Burns. And I guess, you know, can maybe be an ongoing discussion. I don't know how many other states allow for it to be tax divisible, or how many, you know, other vendors kind of have this IT piece figured out. But, you know, it is something that I've heard from individuals where, because of this, it does add to their health care costs considerably if they have one, you know, more high needs health person in their family, but it doesn't put into the whole family, and because of deductibles and everything, it creates a very real burden. And so I guess I'd just be interested to know, understanding that the federal exchange does have this capability, if there is a timeline for when this would be a deliverable, and where it does fall. And I understand that there are a lot of priorities in terms of the public programs, the counties, the IT needs, the life change events, but would just be interested to know if this is on the radar somewhere with some sort of a timeline for when that would be a deliverable outcome that Minnesotans could expect. And that would probably also be the case. I believe House File 5, in my language, to Mr. Lights, what we were talking about earlier in terms of the delivery of information to the plans, I think we have within 48 hours. And I understand that at one time in a hearing that was considered very concerning in terms of a tight time turnaround. However, I guess I would just be interested in, again, if there's a timeline on that being kind of a deliverable, at which point plans could assume that maybe 48 hours would be tough, but for sure within a week or something like that, as we know that we're dealing with people who are waiting quite a long time sometimes for insurance cards, and to know that they are in fact properly enrolled in the plan they chose. So timelines on that would be, if they exist, would be great to see.
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, yeah, we'll, I don't know that I have the specifics on what the current timeline is, but we can do some very quick work on that and get you some ballpark around what would be a reasonable time frame.
Thank you, Mr. Lights. And Mr. Lights, if you could just maybe, I know that you're familiar with House File 5 and the House bill, as well as the Senate bill, and there's differences. But one of the things that we tried to do was to respond to constituents that members had who were having great difficulty in dealing with the enrollment process, and people who tried to enroll and couldn't enroll, people who thought they were enrolled and found out they weren't enrolled, or members of their family weren't enrolled, and tried to get at some accountability that Minnesotans could actually sign up, and when they signed up that they knew they had insurance, and that happened in a timely manner. I know Representative Mack's bill tries to get at some of that. Is there anything in the House bill that you feel that MNsure cannot currently do with the current funding and personnel that you have in order to make that happen under the time frames that we have within the bill?
Mr. Chair, and in thinking about the various provisions, certainly the provisions that we've just been discussing with Representative Mack are ones that, in the context of the concerns or comments that we've laid out, are ones that I think we, at least with regards to the transfer of information, the exemptions that we talked about are ones that we can accommodate within the existing resources. I think, as Ms. Burns has mentioned, the divisibility issue is one that would need is a little would probably bump some up against some of the other things that we're trying to accomplish. But we do recognize that's something that we will need to tackle as we move forward on things. So I think, with regards to House File 5, that's kind of where we would land on those provisions.
All right. And just with some of the backlog information that we have, Mr. Leitz, if you could kind of let us know where you are with the qualifying life event changes in the backlog, where are we with that, and what is the current backlog of QLEs that you currently have, and if you could get that information to us and maybe just give us an overview of how that's going. It's been one of the things that we hear about the most in terms of our backlogs, of what is the current status of that and where do you see that moving forward in the weeks ahead.
Mr. Chair, let me I'll give you what I know on that. Ms. Burns may have a little bit to add as well, but you're right that one of, I think, the more vexing issues that's frustrated everybody, myself included, has been the inability for us to rapidly process life event changes or change in circumstances that are commonly referred to as well. And these are things such as changes in income, changes in address, changes in a marital status or other things. We have made it in our release schedule for the coming months a very high priority of adding the most key changes. There are 22 or so things that kind of qualify in the category of a life event, but some of the more common ones are adding coverage or changing of income, changing in the status of marital. And we, in the release that will be done this month, will be adding a coverage. Will be one of those life events that will be added into the system. So that will be electronic as opposed to the, while electronic, more cumbersome system. And what we'll be doing here is what are called wizards, which will allow those changes to go much more rapidly. It's a computer term, apparently, from what I hear, that allows those changes to go into the system much more rapidly. There will be 5 additional life events that will be added. That functionality will be added in the July release. So it's very much a high priority, and it's very much a priority that's occurring early on in our release schedule for adding that functionality. So those will be things that will improve the challenges that county workers have in making those changes, as well as my own caseworkers at MNsure who have to make those changes as well. I don't know, Katie, if you have anything additional to add on that, on the life event functionality, in addition to what I had there.
And Ms. Burns, do you know what the current backlog for QLEs is?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the current number that we are working on is about 1,250 as of this morning.
Thank you. All right. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Scherer.
Just to stay on, was 1250, right? Thank you. And Mr. Leitz, I'm looking at your flow diagram, which is something I highly value, and I just want to make sure I'm understanding what I'm reading here, because I asked for us to be able to see markers of improvement rather than just conversations about improvement. And the green is indicating that in those months, those are the tasks that you achieved, correct? And according to it's work completed. So that I can anticipate, based on this graph, that at the end of May, and certainly by July, that the 5 components, or 6 components in May will be green. Is that what I can anticipate? That those are tasks that you expect to be completed, worked on in May and completed by July, and that kind of movement. So as it relates to what Representative Dean was talking about, functionality component or life events, you're going to implement 1 through 6 high priority items in May and then pick up the remaining high priority items by the end of July. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, yes, what you've said is accurate. Based on our current timeline, we would anticipate adding our highest priority life event in the May release, and then in July, adding five additional life event priorities. And so you would anticipate, as this moves forward, that becoming green, assuming that the testing and the implementation goes as planned.
I appreciate that. Excuse me. I should ask if I may continue. This is the tool that I have been asking for to show movement as a result of your efforts through the complex sets of demands that are placed on you for improvement. So, and this is your anticipated movement plan, and as we go forward, more become green. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, that is correct.
And so then by the time we get through December, we can anticipate, if you were going on a scale from 1 to 100, 100 being, you know, as good as you're going to get, where will we be on that scale based on this graph?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, I would say that as we move through the course of the summer and the fall and into the early winter, it's our anticipation that with this release schedule, we will have a large number of the key priority core functionalities completed or into the system that aren't currently there. That doesn't mean that every single thing that would be ideal will be there. That's part of what the next set, which would be 2016. There will be some additional things that you'll start to see added as boxes for 2016. We're really working right now on what the 2015 release schedule is. But what we focused on here were the priorities that really rose up during our deliberations in our consultation with the health plans and the counties and others as the key things that needed to be added. And so we fully anticipate, just as you see that March and April are green and those were successful implementations, similarly, as we move through the rest of the year, you should see that turning green as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we do have a minute here as well to answer questions on that. But, Mr. Burns, I just had an update from earlier that showed a backlog, and earlier this week, actually, for QLEs in MNsure of 1,303 and in our public plans of 17,061 for a total backlog of 18,364. Would that be accurate?
Mr. Chair, the number that I was referencing were for qualified health plans because that is at MNsure what we're responsible for resolving. So the number that you cited that was the roughly 1,300 number, that has dropped to roughly 1,250 this morning.
And would Minnett be the best person to respond to the other portion of that, or...? I guess we'll probably chat with them in a little bit, but we can ask that, or Commissioner Justin, I'm sure we can discuss that as well. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this goes back to the previous line of question that Senator Sharon had and to Mr. Leitz with that. As we're changing these blues to greens and as we're looking at the 2016 project list and where we get from there with the federal funding running out at the end of the year, what's the plan for funding these projects into 2016 and beyond?
Mr. Chair and Senator Schumacher, we were fortunate to have received some additional federal funding to be able to, I think, accelerate and continue the build-out throughout 2015. And what you see represented in this chart is really the initial priorities that we've established for ensuring get done in 2015. I think that the, as I mentioned to Senator Sharon, there is a likelihood that there will be, well, not just a likelihood, there will be some additional priorities that will now be added once these are ticked through for 2016. We have received indication from the federal government that they, in addition to allowing us to expend these funds in 2015, to the extent that we have funds that were not expended in 2015, we would have the authority to be able to expend those into 2016 to continue the build-out. And we do fully anticipate that we will not be able to exhaust all the federal resources on the timeline of 2015, and rather we'll have some carry-forward dollars that will likely be used in 2016 to continue with those priorities.
Mr. Mr. Chair. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Lights. Do you have any idea in your projections on just how much that might be?
Mr. Chair and Representative, at this point in time, I don't. Minute may be in a better position to answer that question, or we can certainly work with them to get you what our estimates are around what we would anticipate for a 2015 versus additional funds into the future. I simply don't have that on the top of my head.
Thank you.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Lights, for spending some time with us this afternoon. Welcome, Ms. O'Toole. Congratulations. You mentioned what the One Life event is. I'll be rolled out yet this month. What are the five major ones we're waiting for on the July key here? It says Life Events Entry Phase 2, five remaining high priority items. I'm just wondering what those are.
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas, the one this month is the ad coverage one, which we think is the most key one. I believe the remaining five.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Scott Peterson with Minute Services, the CIO, DHS, and Minsure. And I didn't entirely hear the question. I apologize.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Zerwas. I'm wondering for what's on the release plan project status coded in blue under July. In the second box down, it says Life Event Entry Phase 2. It says the five remaining high priority items, and I'm just wondering what life event changes those would be.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the initial item, as Mr. Lights mentioned, is the ad coverage. The team that put together this list, too, was the counties in coordination with DHS and Minsure as well. The remaining items are add newborn, add a person, address change. That's correct. An income. There's actually been two combined, to add newborn and add a person, or combined into a single wizard.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Thank you very much. Follow-up question for Mr. Lights.
Our representatives are wrong.
Or perhaps for Ms. O'Toole, since she'll be taking over. How confident are we that we can follow the project plan laid out and presented to the committee today? Because I have one from November of 2013 in which we said by December of 2013 we would address whole life events, address, contact info, we would do redeterminations based on income, and we'd have all of those wrapped up by December of 2013. Then in February of 2014 you put out another update that said, again, that we were just about to deliver casework, self-service changes, life changes for all of the categories, and renewals, along with the additional eligibility stuff. And so, granted, we have it in color this time, but I'm just wondering if we're on a pace where this time we think we can do it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas, I'll start. Mr. Peterson may want to add something to that. I think that a couple things. One is that the project status release plan that you have in front of you is one that we took, I would say, an extraordinarily realistic approach on. I think one of the things that, in referencing the November 2013 document that you did, I can't speak specifically to it, but it sounds unrealistic to me, and it probably was unrealistic at the time. I think one of the things that we've been very careful about here is saying, what do we realistically think we can accomplish, and set the expectation that that's what's going to get accomplished and nothing more beyond that, and that we had to make some tough decisions and setting priorities, and there was things left off lists that people wanted, but we had to sort of say – let's think about the resources that we have, our past track, the past track record in the last couple of years in vendors delivering and other things, and realistically think about what can we deliver. And when you look at what we put down for March as what we were planning to do, it got delivered. What we put down for April, we delivered on an off-cycle thing. So I have much higher confidence, certainly, today because of that, because of the project structure that is now in place, and it's a very clear one that we have now that we did not have back a year and a half ago. So my confidence is actually very, very good that it can be delivered. That doesn't mean that there aren't things that can occur during the processes of IT development that might cause you to veer off schedule or not be able to meet certain timelines. But I think one of the additional things that we have committed to collectively between MinSure, DHS, and Minit is to be really quite crystal transparent about where we're at with things and to note where we are, whether we're green or not. But I would say that my confidence level is certainly substantially higher than it was would have been a year ago in this, because I think we do have a very clear process in place to make these changes.
I have just one last question, Mr.
Representative Ross.
For Ms. O'Toole, we're in our last bucket of money for these fixes, and I think Representative Schumacher touched on it a little bit as well, but we have huge concerns that, you know, we've been pushed off several years and been told time and time again, quite frankly, that these fixes were in hand, that they were months away, and sometimes we were told they were weeks away. It turns out they were years away and not yet realized. If the money runs out, if the time runs out here in 2015 and some of the boxes don't turn green, they're still light blue or blue, what's your plan financially to getting MinSure and the exchange and everything up to speed to where, quite frankly, we were told by the administration it would be 2.5 years ago with no more money?
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas, I think that the ability to have some additional resource, to have a much clearer defined process and a much more realistic prioritization of the fixes that are going in is part of the answer to that question that I believe we're going to be able to deliver on. Secondly, and Mr. Peterson might be able to speak to this a little bit more, the system itself is one that we simply understand collectively a lot better than we did 2 years ago. It was a new system that was up and running, and frankly, knowledge of a system you get better with it over time. And so I have very good confidence that within the budget that we've received, both from the federal government and ongoing, through the funding that the build out will be able to occur. So the plan will be to continue along with realistic release plans within the resources we have available to knock off the various things that still have not been added for functionality.
Just Mr. Lights, and just to kind of go through a little bit about, not to go back and rehash missed targets or to cover old ground, but just more prospectively, looking forward, obviously we need to anticipate the number of enrollees, the revenue associated with enrollees, and the expenses for MinSure moving forward in the 24 months following July 1st. That's our job. And part of that is trying to figure out, again, where we're going to be with projections. How many people currently are you predicting will be in MinSure in the next year? How many people are going to be signing up? And how many folks will we have both in the QHP and the public side that we currently figure on?
Mr. Chair, when we talk first about the QHP side and what we're anticipating, the budget that was submitted to the legislature in March makes the following anticipated numbers. So we anticipate that will end this year with around 60,000 QHP enrollees, give or take. So some, right around 60,000 QHP enrollees. We also then anticipate that for enrollment year 2016, which would encompass the upcoming open enrollment period starting in November, that we would add an additional 35,000 enrollees during that period, so that the essential number that you're working with for enrollment year 2016 is 95,000 enrollees. And then we would anticipate that by the end of enrollment year 2017, there would be an additional 35,000 with an ending number of around 130,000 enrolled in qualified health plans. I don't have the specific numbers for basic health plan or Minnesota Care or Medicaid enrollees in front of me. DHS may be able to answer what they're holding in the forecast for that, but that's sort of the QHP side of the assumptions.
And Mr. Leitz, what will happen if that's about a 40% increase in enrollment and we've missed those marks in the past by a lot? What will happen if we don't get those additional folks through the front door? What's the backup plan?
Mr. Chair, a couple of things on that. The first is that one of the things that we had occur this year that we do not anticipate having in subsequent years is the in year one, you had Preferred One, which chose not to offer on the exchange, and in year two. And that did take some enrollees out of the system that we, many of whom came back through, but not fully everyone did. And so we actually added 37,000 new enrollees during this open enrollment period, in addition to the renewals that came through the system. So we brought in more new people than we did in renewing people. We're not anticipating that we'll have that same phenomena, but we do anticipate that the base that we'll be working from renewal will still be adding additional members to that. If it were to be the case that the enrollment that we anticipate or project does not materialize, then we will need to make adjustments on the expenditure side of the ledger. We operate based on sales that occur through the exchange and an assessment on those sales. We operate based on that revenue, and then we have to match that to the expenditure side. And so what we would need to do, if that were not to materialize, would be to make some decisions around how to prioritize on the expenditure side to ensure we're able to deliver the customer service and deliver the enrollment experience that people expect and figure out how best to accomplish that.
And Mr. Leitz, could you talk just a little bit about the federal government application for an additional grant that was received, where we are with that grant, the latest grant that came through? And we kind of went through that, I believe, a little bit in committee of after that was awarded, what the plan was for that money. And just talk a little bit about where we are with that and rolling out that money and how we see that projected moving forward.
Mr. Chair, I'll certainly start with that. I might ask Mr. Peterson from Minute to join at the table since they are also very actively involved in that grant.
Mr. Chair, before he answers that question, I just wanted to go back to the QHP enrollment questions. I know you transitioned into
Senator
the next
Hayden.
One. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Leitz, you had spoke a little bit about the Preferred One not renewing their contract, their relationship with Minsure. Can you give us a sense of the percentage and the real numbers that were enrolled in Preferred One via the exchange, and then what came back through and versus what you lost that was there? I think that's an important distinction. You had said that you had 37,000 new people, but because of the Preferred One relationship dissolving, you lost a lot of people. So can you just give us a little more of a breakdown? So I think that, Mr. Chair and committee members, that helps us to put in perspective if we're kind of trying to get a sense of how Minsure is doing and where they're moving forward. This anomaly of having a very large insurer drop out of the exchange, what that really meant to you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, sure, I'd be very happy to. We ended the first open enrollment period by enrolling around 46,000 individuals in qualified health plans. That was the first open enrollment period. About 64% or about two-thirds of those were people who enrolled in Preferred One. You might recall that Preferred One had very low premiums, and they captured a fairly large portion of the market share. So about 24 or 26,000 of those 40-some-odd thousand individuals who enrolled in our through MinSure in year one were enrolled in Preferred One. When Preferred One opted not to offer products on the exchange in year two, under state law, people automatically renew into automatically stay in their policy unless they take another action. And so folks, in a sense, were set about two-thirds of our initial year enrollment was set to auto-renew off of MinSure unless people took an action, which is a very large proportion of what we had. We ended up actually getting a chunk of those folks to come back through MinSure, you know, shop and compare and choose a plan through MinSure. About 23,000 people were renewals who came back through. Not all of those Preferred One. Obviously, we had Blue Cross, Medica, Health Partners, and UCare who also offered. So some of those folks were enrolled in those products. They renewed in through MinSure. So we had about 23,000 renewals, a chunk of which maybe 10,000 were Preferred One. Then we also added about 37,000 new members. So we had about 20-some-odd thousand renewals and about 37,000 new members. We were the only state that had our new enrollees far exceeding our renewals because of that dynamic that we had, and we were actually really pleased to get that additional 37,000 to come back through.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lights, if just hypothetically, if the Preferred One enrollee stayed on because they would have had to have made another action to get off, but they just said, you know, this works for me, and they stayed on, approximately what would be your numbers today versus where they are now? And then the percentage.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, if we had maintained all of the 46,000 then added an additional 37,000 during that open enrollment period, we would be sitting at around 82,000-83,000 right now in the exchange on the qualified health plan side, which would be approximately, it's you know, we're at about 60,000, so it's about another third more.
And then, Mr. Chair, if I may, Mr. Lights, and then where would that have put you relative to some of the projections you had at the time?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, we would be certainly closer to the original projections that we had. I don't have them sitting right in front of me, so I don't have the specifics, but we would be much closer to what we had than we had originally anticipated. And quite frankly, to your point, we were realistic when Preferred One did decide not to offer, and we did lower our projections because of that, and we actually came, I think, very close to meeting those projections, and we would have certainly been much higher had had they stayed, been able to stay in for year two.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lights.
And Mr. Lights, well, I think we'll probably hear from the plans later in terms of why they did not choose to re-enroll. Mr. Peterson, do you have anything else to add on the update for our IT grant from the federal government, and just how much money did they say we could have, and what are we supposed to do with it, and how much have we spent, and those kinds of updates?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I don't have a breakdown in front of me, but we can definitely provide that back to you. I can speak to the categories that we've have spoken about in previous committees, and just talk through where the expenditures have been made to date. Currently, the primary focus has been on staff ramp up, and there were two separate staff lines in the grant item. One was a state staff item, and one was an augmented staff item on the contract side. So we can provide you those line items and where the breakouts are at. The other areas has just been around logistics and space and workstations and things like that to bring this amount of staff on to separate the work streams out to be able to accomplish the work that you see on the release plan that's in front of you. The other items include, I believe last time we spoke, the IBM contract was expiring on 4/30. There's been a contract extension created for that, so that's completed as well. And then there's ongoing license negotiations. There's a couple other line items that included additional licenses necessary for both environments to continue the development effort, as well as licensing for the workstations and just software for the developers that are coming on site.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. And just to kind of to circle back with Mr. Lights, perhaps, just moving forward, I think from just from what I've been reading about federal exchanges nationally and state exchanges, that the federal money to bail out state exchanges is pretty much drying up or dried up, and that the money that is delivered to states has a higher level of scrutiny now than it did 2 years ago. And that not be used, for example, for operating expenses. Your current budget shows about $5.3 million in revenue and about $8.1 million in expenses. Do you see the numbers, obviously, are going to be based on your projected enrollment, which we've kind of covered already? Do you see that MNsure will be able to pay its bills without tapping into any revenue sources outside of MNsure and outside of the grants from the federal government for operating?
Sir, Mr. Chair, I apologize. I was just getting my head around the 5.3 and the 8.1. I think you're referring to fiscal year 15. Is that what you're referring to? Certainly, we look at the budget as a whole, and so it involves both the money that we bring in from premium withhold, the money that we have from cost allocation on the Medicaid side, and any federal dollars that we have for the IT build-out, and then we match that up against our expenditures. And we do that in this three-year financial plan that we've put out, certainly over a series of years. And if you look at, for example, fiscal year 16, we have a premium withhold that goes up to a little bit higher level of $8.6 million and is matched up against, again, the expenditures that we have that are either directly related to MNsure or cost allocated with the Medicaid program. So we do anticipate that the budget is balanced. It is a balanced budget for the three-year time period that we're examining here. As I've said earlier, to the extent that we find that our revenues or enrollment does not match, either comes in too high, it comes in higher than we anticipate, or lower, that'll be something that we'll then need to make adjustments on, either the withhold side or the expenditure side, to ensure that we, if we bring in more revenue than we anticipate, that might actually provide an opportunity to lower withholds. If we bring in less enrollment than we would anticipate, then we obviously will need to make adjustments on the expenditure side to do that. But we do fully anticipate that we will be able to balance out that budget over time, as would any organization that is dependent on the type of funding resources that we have.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, we're looking at the release plan and talking about the plans going forward, and I guess I need to ask the extent to which they're reliant on the DHS resources for MNsure that are built into the Senate's position and not built into the House position, and how that changes things if you don't have that. I mean, I think that most of us would agree that these are absolutely necessary improvements for our IT and require the resources necessary to achieve those, and I'm just wondering the extent to which the investments that the Senate put into making sure that we can deliver on these issues are needed for that build-out.
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lurie, they are absolutely critical to the build-out. That funding is necessary to be able to draw those federal dollars in to allow us to really do the build-out, as Mr. Peterson has described, and continue to make sure that we've, over the course of this year and into next year, really finalize and finish out the build. So they're absolutely critical.
Senator Lurie.
So, Mr. Chair, then under the House proposal, we can kind of just draw a line somewhere in the middle of this and say MNsure's not able to get any better, not able to improve, not able to deliver on what Minnesotans are expecting, and terms of being able to continually improve our eligibility systems is, I think, what I heard.
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lurie, certainly it would limit the resource that would be available to do that and would limit our ability to do the complete build-up.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Mr. Lights, how much has been spent on MNsure to date?
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, I don't know that I can give you the exact amount that has been spent. I can tell you that the funds that have been allocated via largely federal sources has somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 million.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Lights, I guess just a couple of questions and comments. You know, as we talk about what we're going to do going forward, I think there seems to be, when we talk about build out, certainly we can agree that the things on this page and on this map are essential. I guess when I hear the word build out, sometimes that builds in the understanding that the baseline was put in place and now you're building on top of that. I would argue that most of the things on this page we should have had right out of the get-go or should have been taken care of a long time ago. And we all know that the challenges with some of the, you know, whether it's vendors, project management, all these things, but, you know, we're $200 million in. We're referring to, you know, completing a build-out, kind of leaving the assumption to the public that's listening that the original product was delivered on and now we're building on top of that. I would argue that the original product was never delivered on. We're still just trying to get that part done and that part right for people. And so I think we just need to be clear about that and understanding the Senate's proposal and kind of filling in the gaps to get some of this stuff done, and whether or not the House leaves that short, I think could be argued. Understanding that I think a lot of the frustration that continues to build around this issue is that $200 million has been invested, and we are still so far from many of the promised deliverables. Representative Zerwas highlighted that in many ways. And so a lot of the frustration that tends to come out in these conversations is that. And I guess I'm a little concerned on the heels of Chair Dean's comments about the budget, and I guess as if we know that the federal government's going to be scrutinizing more and more how these dollars are spent, and that it's very clear that those dollars need to be used towards startup and getting the IT in place and not operations, I guess I'm not very well assured that there are clear lines in the sands or clear buckets in the way that MNsure is accounting for dollars to make sure that we are not using those federal dollars in a way that they're not supposed to be used. And I didn't necessarily hear a rebuttal to the fact that we have, give or take, about a $3 million gap between what's coming in and what's going out just in 2015, but that it sounded like, well, this will just, the numbers just tend to work themselves out at the end of the day. And so, you know, I guess that's a little bit of a concern in terms of how those dollars are being spent, much less assurances going forward that this thing is financially stable. I guess the one question I have on this, and maybe to Mr. Peterson, as we look at this map, could you give any delineation as to what on this sheet is attributed to Curum's responsibilities and what's Minute? I mean, what of these, and I know the Curum contract got extended. I guess if you could tell us till when, and then what's attributed to what Curum's responsible for on this versus what Minute's responsible. Is there any type of a breakdown on that?
Mr. Peterson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, if you look at the chart, the most things related to the eligibility portion of the application itself are related to Curum. I think that the Minute has a role in each of these in the project management space as well as the business analysis space and just working with both MNsure and DHS. So I think Minute crosses the board on all these projects. And we can send you something that's color-coded so you get a full view of what the IBM picture looks like on the IBM contract. It was extended through the end of the year, so through 12/31 of 15.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mack.
Thank you. And Mr. Peterson, and if any of these numbers are wrong, so we're $200 million spent so far. We this year have got 34 in federal grants with another $60 million coming, which will put us right up towards $300 million. I'm wondering, how far does that get us on this sheet? Does that get us all the way through December and all these deliverables with that extra $90 million coming for the feds? Or, you know, I guess to Senator Lori's point, where would we have to draw the line on this, because $90 million is only going to get us this far on this sheet? Could you give us some detail on that?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, yes. So the expectations at this point was we'll meet deliverables within each of these boxes throughout the end of the year. Now, I think we spoke previously on the scope that's very well defined and then what's not. The May release is already in the test environment, so we're confident of delivery in that. The July release has been shaped up and scoped. We know what the scope is of that. Some of the larger projects that are out towards the end are still being scoped, and work is just getting started on those as staff roll onto the project. So the expectation, I think, as Mr. Light said earlier, that the expenditure of the existing grant funding likely won't occur through the end of the year and likely will extend into 2016. From a minute perspective, we working this plan right now is the business priorities, and then as business adds additional priorities for 2016, we can answer that question better for you.
So Mr. Chair and Mr. Peterson, so if I hear you correctly, that the $90 million in federal grants, I think you just said, won't be expended completely in 2015. And considering that this runs us up to the end of 2015, the $90 million should be enough, or more than enough, to get every deliverable on this sheet done. Am I understanding correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. I think the key is the scope of the items in these, in the buckets, in the further out releases in July, September, and December. Those are still being scoped currently. So, you know, what you have on the list is a very high-level item, and I'll speak to, say, NAV broker functionality. There's a lot of pieces of functionality that those partner communities want, and we'll have to define, again, like we've done with the counties and our carrier partners, what the most critical aspects are to deliver these in phases throughout the end of the year.
Okay, so Mr. Chair and Mr. Peterson, so is that kind of a negotiation process to a certain extent? I mean, this is mostly happening, I would imagine, between Minute, Curum, and the counties. If Curum is responsible for a lot of the eligibility determinations, obviously that's really key to the counties. Life events are maybe more up to Minture and Minute to get that part figured out, I'm assuming. Although, as I understand it from some conversations with Mr. Lights, once life events are fixed, it's fixed in both public program and QHP. That's fixed across the board. I guess I'm just wondering, to what extent are the negotiations, hey, this is how much money we have to work with, here's how we prioritize, and just how scrupulous that process is, understanding the shrinking dollars and finite resources.
Mr. Peterson.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, it's more of a context of discussing with the business the functionality that's needed and required, and then going back to IBM, having them provide, and I'll speak with IBM, to IBM, there's other vendors engaged as well, but going back to them, they have to provide a level of effort to deliver on that specific piece of functionality. Minute is the arbitrator between whether or not that's a reasonable estimate or not, and then if it's determined it's reasonable, moving forward on that, and then they get paid as that deliverable is completed based on the functionality that was requested from business.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, just to understand the mechanics of that, so once Minute and Curum agree that it's an acceptable expectation and that Curum will get paid whatever amount of money for that deliverable, they're not paid until that deliverable comes through if it's been agreed that it was a realistic expectation.
That's correct. So the contract is based on them providing skill sets to achieve a deliverable. And the deliverable is based on the level of effort they provide. So when they complete it, then they're paid on that action item or on that item.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lights, welcome. Did you run your half marathon yet? Did you finish that?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, no, but it's upcoming. Thank you for asking.
You're still training. Good. Well, we had a nice visit the last couple of months in our office regarding Minsure, and I just wanted to get you updated on how your training is going. It's never easy. I know that. I had a question similar to Representative earlier, but regarding the $90 million, and I think the gentleman from IT, or Minute, answered some of that, but Earlier in the year in our committee at Health and Human Services, there was an allocation. There was a request of $109 million to help fix MinSure. And of that, I think you got awarded $92.5 million. But my question is, if that is what it will cost at this point to fix the fixes that are necessary to be up and operational and to fulfill the chart, is there any left over then that will attain your goals of marketing and other areas in which you needed to make sure that MinSure was on its feet and working?
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, the funding that we receive from CSIO is really funding that that's the federal money that we the additional federal funding that we received is really funding that is restricted to being things for the IT development and completion of that, as well as enhanced customer service things such as ensuring that we have appropriate call center processes in place, for example, to be able to make sure that people get enrolled. And we have some very limited ability to use those dollars in any other way other than those. And really, when we look at our budget, things like marketing, communications, the things that are important to make sure that people know how to get coverage, where to get it, that they're required to have it under the way the federal law is structured, comes out of the funding that we receive by selling in policies by having people enrolled in policies through the exchange and then having an assessment placed on them. Those dollars are really used for those services.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So then, that is the 3.5%. Is that correct? Now, if I recall right, a couple years ago, that was the high number, kind of on the high side. And I remember some meetings that there was some talk that maybe you wouldn't necessarily need to go to that particular 3.5%, and that if anything, it'd be lower than that. Do you project, perhaps going in the future, looking forward, that you'd be able to lower that percentage rate on the plans?
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, I think everyone would very much like to ensure that that is as low as possible. Right now, it is at 3.5%. That is where the federal exchange also sets its assessment level, so we're aligned with where the federal government is on that particular assessment. That's necessary right now as we for us to fund our resource or fund our operations. I think moving forward, based on whatever enrollment is, if enrollment turns out to be higher than we anticipate, that would provide that opportunity to be able to, you know, start to look at the assessment and determine the appropriate level. And that's something that certainly my board looks at now, what's the appropriate assessment level. I think they felt it was necessary at this point in time to have it at that 3.5% level to ensure that we're able to fund our operations in these early stages of development of the exchange. But I think as things evolve moving forward, that's something that's going to probably be looked at fairly regularly as to both the expenditure level that's being used, what the revenues are that are coming in, and then those revenues being based on enrollment. You can certainly look at the assessment level to see if it's set at the appropriate level to match up to the expenditures.
So, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. O'Toole, if they do reach the projections of the enrollments, do you anticipate and will you be able to say, hopefully with certainty, that the withholding of 3.5% can be reduced going forward?
Ms. O'Toole.
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, thanks for the question. I'm not here to guarantee that right now, but I think I support what Mr. Light said. We will look at this, and it'd be great for us to be able to reduce that. And I think the board has had their eye on that and will continue to. And what I can promise you is complete transparency when we get to those points.
And then, Mr. Chair, a closing last question. I had some folks from my district that had some concerns regarding the premium costs to them. So I'm just curious, what is the average premium cost currently for those who are enrolled?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, it varies based on the region, and it varies based on the type of plan that folks are enrolling in. So I think we would have to probably get back to you with some of the ranges of what those look like, but it really just depends on the rating region that people are in, and then whether they're choosing a platinum plan, a gold plan, a silver plan, a bronze plan. But we can certainly provide those comparisons if that would be helpful for the committee.
Mr. Chair. So, yes, it would. So both the out-of-pocket cost to each person enrolled and then the actual cost of the premium would be, I think, very necessary for me as a lawmaker as well.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. And to Mr. Leitz, I just want to just have to point this out, that when we were in the Health and Human Finance Committee in the last term, we were assured by Ms. Malmoff that although the cap was raised to 3.5%, that even if projections were, quote, off of that or below, that she did not anticipate that that would, in fact, go that high. We cannot raise that currently without additional statutory changes moving forward. So if you hear members who are concerned about missed enrollment projections or withholds from the plans, that's why. That is our experience that we have had. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to go back to the recommendations from the OLA report that I don't think we've touched on yet around the table. And just a few of the key recommendations that I'll just read off is that the legislature should consider whether to retain the Minsure Board as a governing body or to make it purely advisory. The legislature should amend statutes to formally create a governance structure for Minsure's enrollment system and ensure that Minsure's future information technology work is subject to oversight with minute services, that insurance brokers should be fairly compensated, and that Minsure should improve its ability to access and analyze the applicant and enrolling data it collects. So I just wanted to get comments from Ms. Wolf and Mr. Leitz as far as how they view this OLA report that we take very serious around the table and in this building, and what are you doing to accommodate those recommendations?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, we too at Minsure take all the work of legislative auditor extraordinarily seriously and respect greatly the work that he and his staff do. It's always a very valuable exercise to go through the audit because you learn many things that can help improve your operations. With regards to the specific recommendations, my board hasn't taken any positions with regards to the governance of Minsure. That's not something that I have any ability to really comment on absent a board direction on that. I do know that they have certainly read the report and are aware of what the recommendations were in that regard, but haven't taken any positions on that. With regards to the governance of the enrollment system, that is something that we have informally put in place, it's what I described earlier with regards to the project management structure that we have developed over the course of the last 6 to 9 months, where Minute Services is really taking the lead on being the point organization with regards to the IT development and ensuring that working with the vendors, the continued build-out and conclusion of the system is underway. And then DHS and Minsure as business organizations really work with Minute to make sure they're certain of our needs. And then we are able to, as a group, prioritize what those are between the various business needs that we have, and then Minsure carries that out. Speaking specifically from my perspective, I have no concerns about that being added as a statutory provision. I think one of the things the legislative auditor pointed out in his report is that we've been able to accomplish this work voluntarily because we have a very strong commitment among the three agencies to ensure that that governance structure put in place. But you can't always bind future leaders of organizations to do that thing. And by adding it to statute, you could actually put that in place a little bit more cleanly. So I personally have no – I don't have any concerns with that aspect. With regards to the minute – the exemptions on the minute side, we spoke about those a little bit earlier in the testimony. Those are ones that we, by and large, follow anyway. And so from our perspective, those are ones that we're very comfortable should the legislature decide that you would prefer to have those exemptions repeal. I don't think we would have any major concerns with that because we have it's important that procurement laws are followed. It's important that we work with our partners at Minute very closely. And so I don't think there would be any major concerns with a particular aspect of it. With regards to the broker aspect of the legislative auditor's report, one of the things that I committed to when I took this job, and I know that Ms. O'Toole has expressed a similar commitment moving forward, is that We very much value the work that all of our partners do in helping folks get enrolled, whether that's counties and helping people enroll in Medicaid in the Minnesota Care Program, whether that's navigators who are working across qualified health plans, Medicaid and Minnesota Care, to get folks enrolled, or whether it's the longstanding role that agents and brokers have played. And certainly ensuring that they're compensated at a level for enrolling people in either qualified health plans or Minnesota Care or Medicaid is very, very important for them to be able to functionally do their work so that they're compensated for the work that they're doing. I can say from an aggregate perspective, that certainly makes a ton of sense to me. To the extent that there are fiscal impacts to that, that's something that obviously you'll need to take into consideration. But from the perspective of getting folks enrolled, they certainly play a very, very valuable role. And then I think the final recommendation that you mentioned, Senator Rosen, related to data and the ability to of us to be able to more fully analyze data that comes out of the MnSure system. And that is something that we, too, agreed with that recommendation. It is dependent on our ability to continue to improve the quality of the information that's in the system, as well as our ability to extract that information. And the system that was brought up in the first year was a young system. It was immature, and some of the things that you would like to be able to do in terms of data analysis simply weren't able to do so, because we were really focusing on the core functions of getting people through the system and getting that information to the health plans. I think as the system matures, since we now have an enrollment system of record, which allows us to track people across the system in a way that we weren't able to in year one, a lot of that data analysis capability will certainly be able to be built out in a much more robust way than it is now. I think it's going to be incremental, and I think it's going to be improving over time, but it certainly is something we take very seriously and agree with that recommendation as well.
Thank you. And Mr. Lights, just to follow on that, Senator Rosen brought up the recommendations of the OLA and the oversight structure. That just kind of brings up a question of the board. We have two open appointments on that. Do you have any guidance of when those appointments might be made in the governor's appointment for the permanent CEO?
Mr. Chair, the terms of two of the board members expired. You might recall that in the statute there are certain categories of individuals who are appointed to the board, meaning they represent certain interests. The two chairs, or the two seats that expired, were the small business and the consumer chairs. It's my understanding that those have been posted for application through the Secretary of State's office. Those are governor's appointments, and so that it's at the governor's discretion as to when he makes those appointments. It's my understanding that he isn't making those appointments at this point in time, but from what I have heard, it may be at some point into the future that he'll be doing that. With regards to the CEO position, that is a board decision in terms of what they would like to do there. They've obviously asked Ms. O'Toole to serve in an acting capacity, and will, I would anticipate, talk more about that at the May 19th MnSure board meeting.
Thank you. Senator Hayden.
Well, good. Well, Mr. Chair, I've been very, very patient in our overview and review of the MnSure system, its history, what happened. One of the things I'd probably add is we probably could have got started a little early with the planning of this. However, when I was in the minority, we weren't able to hear bills that talked about the exchange. And so I think that that's necessary to kind of add that, since we're doing a review that we had about 2 years or so. I'm looking at Senator Lori of when we sat in the minority, asking the chair to kind of talk about this and hear various bills from various different groups to try to put this together. So if we're going to put it in total context, we must know that we wasted about 2 years of planning before the majority, the current majority, at least in the Senate and in the House at the time, kind of moved quickly to put this together. And I think that that's just important if we were doing that review. But that being said, we're in a conference committee. We got some proposals on the table relative to what we want to do with the future of MnSure. And so I don't know if we, Mr. Chair, plan to talk about those a little bit. I know we also have to talk about Minnesota Care. And I think we've all been pretty patient, and I'm glad that they were able to come and tell us what was the goings on today and what their review is. But it seems to me that we should probably start to move forward, either thanking our participants for giving us a history and an update of where they are, and get down to talking about our proposals and if there's agreement, or, Mr. Chair, and I would begin to tell you how to run your committee, but I know that we also have a very challenging proposals of Minnesota Care that we also should get to, so I would hope that we could do that today.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Senator Sharon.
Well, thank you. I concur with that. I guess I have some questions, though, that give context for me in terms of thinking about the future that I hope that you can help me with. Because when I'm thinking about what we're talking about here is the exchange, I just want to be clear that I'm correct in my mind that the alternative to a state exchange is that we join the federal exchange. But am I correct in my understanding that should that happen, the only part of our exchange that would go to the federal exchange is the qualified health plans, and we would continue to have to budget and manage the public programs at the local level. Is that correct?
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, that is my understanding.
May I continue?
Senator Sharon.
So just based on that, I think we have to consider the fact that a lot of what we're talking about here in terms of this investment from the federal government is that it's allowing us to build a system that will manage our Medicaid programs, Minnesota Care, as well as the qualified health care plans. And to do it otherwise would still create an expenditure for us in the Department of Human Services, a struggle that we've had for a very long period of time of updating that technology that's antiquated and old and was not functioning well every time we wanted to improve or reform the healthcare system. And so I'm glad, I just want to clarify that in my mind. And I was interested in the rates discussion. I know that my part of the state has higher rates than other parts of the state's regional rate setting affects the rates because of how competitive, volume, and what the how old the population is because of the high cost of care to elderly population. And rates are driven by utilization. We all know that. Not by the Affordable Care Act, but by utilization. So what I would wonder about, two questions. One is if... maybe I can say, this $200 million that we keep talking about that we spent, and the auditor's report talks about the fact that we didn't get $200 million worth of work and improvements, but we didn't get zero. I mean, we sort of talk about it like we got nothing, and that's not true. So there is a base that we're building off of with this flow chart. There's a significant number of accomplishments that did occur as a result of that expenditure. Not enough. None of us are satisfied. So we like to see, the dedication and the commitment to improving that. So I appreciate that. But when we're talking about how much money, this is how I'm thinking about it. For any company that's building an IT system to do its operations in this way online, what kind of percentage of the total operations would you consider appropriate to be spent in order to manage a volume of business or dollars? And as I calculate it, there's about $9 billion of public money that we're spending and running through this system. And then that's matched. There's federal matches to that, so that brings that up to around $18 billion. And then, at least on the exchange right now, based on the numbers that you've given us, there's about $1 billion of qualified health plan dollars being managed through the MinSure system. And so when you pull those numbers together and apply it against how much we're spending on IT, the percentage is 1% or maybe a little more than that. And I just would like to know from those of you who have experience at analyzing how much or at what percent of the investment does a company make in its IT system against its volume of work, if that's really as out of line as we might, not that we shouldn't expect productivity from that money, but I just really see this as a percent of the task, the volume of the task that we're doing, is to be about 1%, maybe a little bit more over that. Would you respond to that, Mr. Leitz?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, certainly we take, first of all, we take the investment that's being made here very seriously because it is public dollars and we do recognize the need to get as much value for those dollars as possible. And I think what you are pointing, what you point out with regards to the fact that we used the opportunity here to really leverage the funding to modernize and update some antiquated, some older systems that were at the Department of Human Services, as well as to create the marketplace that we have created through MNsure for qualified health plans, and to really use that opportunity to do that. While the investment is not insignificant on a relative scale, it is, as you point out, not as a percentage, not a large percentage. So I think that you're right that the opportunity to both update and improve the system that was in place at the Department of Human Services, ensure that it was compliant with federal law, one way or another, that updating of the system was going to need to occur, and it could occur on the legacy system, which was 30 years old, or it could occur on a new system, which would allow us to more dynamically move things forward. And so that decision was made, but it also allowed us to create the state-based exchange that we're operating now. And, you know, to that extent, you know, close to 500,000 folks now have been able to come through over that time period and enroll and get a single portal eligibility determination and really get into that coverage. So I think it has, you know, been successful in being able to do that.
On that point, I don't think it really was an option to update our legacy systems. There's no way they could have ever been prepared to match up with the federal hub is my understanding. I mean, so I think I would have that one minor correction. That just wasn't ever and is not today an option. It's been talked about as one a few times, and I need to make sure that the record is pretty clear on that. And maybe you could correct me if I'm wrong.
Mr. Chair, Senator Laurie, you're correct. The amount of effort to do that would be equal to building what we built already in the front-end system, duplicating the eligibility rules and recreating that in a legacy technology that's harder to find skills to operate in.
Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm also interested in moving forward with the proposals that we have in front of us. And to that point, governance structure seems to be a big part of it. My first question, and I have a few questions, if I may. First question is about the MNsure board. Have they ever discussed, to your knowledge, anyone who has been involved in MNsure at a closer level, whether you mentioned that there wasn't a position made formally by the MNsure board, but has there been any public discussions in these meetings, board meetings, where that issue has been discussed, and any learnings from the last couple of years that we can bring into this discussion so we are aware of it, whether it's being a government agency like we have the proposal in the Senate or modifying and then eliminating MNsure as the House proposal talks about. That's my first question about what the position of the board, or maybe not the position, but what discussions have happened at that level, even if you didn't take a position. And the second one is, talking about these two proposals in front of us, there are also private exchanges, around the country. Maybe not a lot, but they do exist. So I'm still trying to figure out, has that ever been discussed, of whether we should be putting the qualified health plans within a private exchange, and then and all the government public programs on a government exchange, and maybe having a hybrid approach? And I know some states have taken that approach. Can you enlighten us and help us understand, in terms of governance structure, can that be done with what we have today? What would it take? And has there been conversations with the MNsure board regarding some of those governance structures?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Senator Franzen, I would say on the governance piece, you know, the board just simply hasn't really taken a position and really hasn't had a lot of robust discussion about that. I think that their perspective, I guess I can't speak for the board, but they have really focused on the operations of the organization and ensuring that they're doing their oversight and work with regards to that, and have really focused their energies more there than thinking about the various, they were working within the structure that they were given, I guess is what I would say. So there really haven't been as many of those. With regards to the private exchanges, and Mr. Peterson might wish to comment on this as well, there certainly have been discussions at the board level about how we, moving forward, leverage the evolving technology that's out there in the marketplace right now. You're absolutely right that, 3 years ago, when states were thinking about exchanges or the federal government, there wasn't a lot of models to work with. But since that time, under the passage of the Affordable Care Act and the way employers have been responding and the way others have been responding, there has been developed web brokers. There have been developed private exchange models that work directly with large employers oftentimes. Many of those are focused on the large employer market as the initial place that they're focusing, but are thinking about, okay, well, how do we now take our business model and move it down into other markets that exist as well? The way that the system was built in Minnesota, I think appropriately so, is that it has a determination portal where folks come in and get an eligibility determination and find out whether they're eligible for Medicaid or Minnesota Care or private health insurance coverage with or without a tax credit. And those pieces are pretty intertwined and appropriately so, because it's a single place of folks that folks can go and get an accurate determination. What occurs after that point is the opportunity to potentially look at whether there are ways to, build on the best of what's in the marketplace right now. But it would involve some disentangling of things that have occurred over time, which would not be a small feat to do. It doesn't mean it shouldn't be looked at, and I can say that the board is actively looking at that, as and Minute has been very helpful in helping think through those options. I think at this point in time, there's a feeling that the pathway that we're on towards the improvement of getting the base in place is very important, but that we should continue to work with outside organizations and vendors to see where they might be able to bring their expertise of the things that they've developed, the tools that they've developed around plan selection or around consumer decision support tools, for example, and try to make sure that we're utilizing those to the largest extent that we can to make it easier for people to more accurately understand the implications of the choices that they're making on the exchange. So, long answer to your question, but I think the answer is yes, we're looking at some of those tools, but I know that the process of going through and examining those things is pretty complex because of the way the system has been built up to this stage.
Just to follow up, Mr. Sure. Chair. And that seems to be part of the issue with MNsure, that we've passed a law, we've sent it over, and you implement the law, and then we realize that, we're on this path, but we have less flexibility to troubleshoot, if you will, based on the first instructions that were given to how we establish MNsure. So whether we end up with the House or Senate proposal, I think we need to really discuss around this table is how do we want to move forward, providing that flexibility to take innovation happening in the private market as well, so we don't tie our hands with something that is inflexible that we keep pouring money into and it just doesn't work and it only works for one thing, but the market changes and then we have to pour in more money to fix it. So I'd like to have that discussion around this table, that we really put our roll up our sleeves and say, what how do we want to move forward? I'd love to have the expertise here, but I think we need to really just delve into the details and say, what are the pros and cons of these two proposals, and can we find a middle ground, and maybe it is to add additional flexibility to look into these areas to really bring in that private perspective, because as you mentioned, I think I'm quoting, take our business model and take it to other markets. You are essentially a business that's being controlled by the government. So in order to actually operate like a business, we need to have that flexibility in place and not so much a tying by the legislature, in my opinion. So how do we get there? How do we keep that innovation in place and maybe look at a hybrid approach that we can agree on? That would be the challenge here, and I'd love to continue to have the conversation to go deeper into these two proposals, hopefully soon today.
Thank you. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I was just having this conversation with Senator Lurie off the floor earlier today. I sit in a very interesting situation where my Republican colleagues are across the table here, and I sit with my Senate Democrat colleagues. And in support trying to support many pieces of the Senate proposal. However, there has been comments that have been made about the MNsure that I do need to respond to as a Republican that was very involved in the MNsure debate back a couple of years ago. And so I just want to respond to Senator Hayden's comments about the Republicans in the House and 2 years ago and all that. Well, we on the Senate floor, the Republicans on the Senate floor, had 138 amendments to the MNsure bill. And one amendment was taken, and it was cut in half, and that was mine. It did not deal with the accountability and transparency of MNsure. And I cannot sit here and support the MNsure proposal coming from the from this side of the table. I do think we do have an opportunity to make some adjustments, as Senator Franzen said. And so I would like to propose a third option for the table that I think we should take a look at it. And it is a hybrid alternative. It is the Senate Republican option of pulling it into the to the Department of Human Services under the commissioner. I had an amendment that we had a debate on the floor when we passed this bill off the floor. And basically, it's very simple. It's eliminates the board. It creates a legislative oversight committee that meets not once a year, but four times a year. It is comprised of health administration people, health care finance folks, health plan purchasing, health care delivery system folks, public health disparities, or the uninsured. Those are all people that should be on that advisory committee. And as I said, it would be under the purview of the commissioner for two enrollment cycles. And then it would come back with a report. There would be a task force on healthcare financing established under this Article 10, Section 66, with a report due back next January, making recommendations on alternatives to MNsure's current structure and operations. If the task force fails to make such recommendations or the legislature fails to act on these recommendations, the Commissioner of Commerce and the Secretary of Health and Human Services shall establish a federal facilitated marketplace for Minnesota as of January 1st of 2018. So that is basically the amendment. I thought that was a reasonable approach to saying we need more time to take a look at this. We should pull it into the department that's doing over 90% of the work anyway, put it on autopilot for a little bit, and make sure that we do not continue to spend more money on something that needs major adjustments, such as the OLA report said. That's why I brought this up. We should go back to the third-party analysis, saying there are some structural issues with this program. And I know, you know, I told Senator Lori I'm going to pick my battle and pick it very well. And this is one of those issues where I just cannot support a state agency. And I hopefully I was upfront with you enough on that, Senator Lori, to make sure that you're comfortable with this. But folks, I do think that we should have a very good discussion about that. And there is a third alternative here that I hope you will take a look at. And it's not just either or, the House or the Senate, because it is going to be very tough to get. There's definitely lines drawn in the sand on both of those proposals.
Fair enough. All right. Well, I think what I'd like to do is, if there's any concluding remarks from Mr. Leitz or Ms. O'Toole, to take those, and then to take just a little bit of a break, about 15 minutes, and then come back with the department and the plans, if they had anything to comment on that. And then we will move to Minnesota Care after that. And obviously, this is a big point. As we've said, this is the point of major differences between the two proposals or three proposals or where we're heading forward and in the House and Senate bill, but also in leadership from the governor and from the legislature of how we move forward. There's going to be no way to wrap up this bill without coming to a conclusion, albeit a two-year conclusion perhaps, regarding the future of these two programs. It's very important. So we do really appreciate your time today and coming in and sharing that with us. And Ms. O'Toole, I want to especially welcome you and thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks. Why don't we come back in about 15 minutes if we could just take a brief recess.
That was okay. I just wanted to, if we're going to tell history.
Coming back to order. Welcome back to the committee, and appreciate everybody getting back. The what we're going to do next is we'd like to have Commissioner Jessen come up, and we want to transition a little bit from MinSure to MinnesotaCare, the two programs, and discuss a little bit about the financing behind that, and more importantly, just kind of the vision for the future from the governor's perspective of both programs, and trying to ensure that low-income Minnesotans and their families have access to affordable and dependable insurance policies. Commissioner Jessen, welcome to the committee. And the first thing that I think we would that was brought up earlier to get covered was the life events and backlog on the DHS side. I think that was brought up earlier, as well as any introductory remarks or any comments that you might have regarding the first part of today's committee testimony. So welcome to the committee, and please proceed, Commissioner.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'm Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Well, maybe I'll say a few things, kind of just reflecting on the MinSure questions and presentation, which will then lead into kind of where we are on the backlog with life events. I certainly am happy about the progress that has been made in MinSure. As the CEO Light said, I think there was a lot of progress done to make this a more consumer-friendly kind of system to work better for consumers. But I also strongly agree that we now really have to turn to making what we think is the back end of the system work better, that the counties, the state, the health plans are all dealing with what comes in after the consumer signs up, whether it's the handoffs or the processing of life events, and so many of those changes. And I think when I look at, I was happy to see this plan that was passed out, and I do think that kind of the matters that have been prioritized for being fixed this year are the right things to be prioritized, and they really focus on making this work better for caseworkers that are managing the cases, and and I think also that applies to the health plans, though I'll let them speak for themselves. But I do want to say, Mr. Chair, that to reiterate something that I think was part of Senator Lori's question is this all only works if we have the Medicaid match to be able to draw down the federal funds, and that is included in the governor's and the Senate's budget. So we have to have those dollars to be able to do this work, which is critical not only for our public program enrollees in health care, but it's really we're trying to build the foundation of a new IT system for all of human services. And so getting this right is just so important to us, far, far beyond MinSure. That doesn't mean MinSure is insignificant, but it just has much broader significance to us in the county. So making this IT progress is just so important to all of our human services work, not just in this health care, this population that's in the exchange. And I would say that this is very much a work in progress. If there's one thing I've learned about IT, it's like you take two steps forward, one step back, and that's on a good day. And I also wanted to say, and I think this expands on something this Scott Peterson was saying, that while we think that we can, with the funding, get a good start on all these things, I want to be clear, I don't think, just one person, but pretty involved, we're going to finish all these things in 15. And that's where it gets down to scoping. We're getting a good start. We're going to scope out what is possible. But a lot of this is going to be ongoing work. But of the work that's on here to us, and I think speaking for DHS and the counties, some of the most important parts are the life events. But maybe I could make one kind of governance comment and then come back to that, if that's all right, Mr. Chair. And I just do want to say that As I think many of you do, I strongly support the OLA's recommendations around governance. And I think that that is that taking steps in that direction, which I think in different ways both of your bills are doing, is very important. I think that, and I also kind of certainly want to endorse Senator Rosen's comment about the fact that, you know, while we need to make kind of some of these governance changes, I support Senator Lori's approach to this as opposed to Senator Rosen's, but understanding, make those now, but we need some time to study this. Because there were a lot of different options for Minsure moving forward. And I think several of you, Senator Franson, I think Representative Mack talked about some of these, I think Senator Sharon did, had mentioned these different possibilities. We need time to look and say, how does this unfold? What does the enrollment look like? What does what the enrollment look like on the QHP side mean for the funding? And whether we need a second look at that. So I do think we really do need that longer-term look, even though I think following quickly some of the OLA recommendations is important. But to go back to your question about life events, Mr. Chair. So as I think we do have about 17,000 life events that are have not been entered for people who've reported them to us. Yeah. And some of those will have gotten addressed actually through our renewals process, but certainly not all of them. And that is why, and we are working very hard on that, but that is why we think getting this life event functionality that is scheduled for this summer to go into place to fix this moving forward is so critical. Because right now we are just so trying to play catch-up. And so are the counties, because they are helping with it. We've now sent out instructions so the counties can help us with this as well. So we need to get this fixed. That's, to me, the number one priority from our perspective. And because if it gets fixed, then we have more time to tackle the backlog, because right now we just have them coming in all the time, and we're trying to do what's coming in as well as playing catch-up for the backlog. So I'm happy to answer any more questions you have about that. It is a challenge, certainly for state and county workers.
Thank you, Commissioner. And one of the things that was brought up earlier was the necessity for Minsure to access $6 million in additional funding in order to access the federal grant money of about $90-some million. And in that, one of the goals within that is to May of this year to get enrollment data to the carriers as a goal that we have that was outlined in the sheet that was put forward. Given that's May of this year, do you think that that is an acceptable expectation for the citizens of the state of Minnesota, that has not yet been met and is in fact a future goal after spending literally hundreds of millions of dollars in rolling this thing out?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not as familiar with kind of the getting the data to the plans as I am with some of the public programs perspectives, and I'll also kind of, Mr. Johnson is more familiar with the grant, may have some things to add, but I would say that there are a number of the missed deadlines that are not acceptable to me. You know, I think I will leave it at that. Is there anything on the grant, Chuck, that you want to add?
Well, Mr. Chair, Chuck Johnson, Deputy Commissioner of Policy and Operations at DHS. As was discussed earlier, there is a request that is in the governor's budget and the Senate bill for additional funding for DHS, which is the state share to draw down the federal Medicaid dollars, which are part of the whole budget for the IT project and the improvements that Mr. Leitz, Mr. Peterson have talked about earlier.
Thank you. Commissioner, you know, just in moving forward, I think from the testimony that we've had on Minsure and where it was, that you as the commissioner do not support taking Minsure under DHS. Could you talk a little bit more about that? You said Senator Rosen brought that up as an opportunity. Could you maybe just describe a little bit more about how you see the proper governance structure and why that might not be a good idea, or why you think it is a good idea to create a new entity at this point?
Well, Mr. Chair, let me just say that I do think there needs to be a change in governance. You know, so there is much of, you know, what Senator Rosen said that, that I agree with. I've publicly stated that I was supported the direction and of Senator Lori's bill, which created a different agency. But to me, that's not adding something new. It's just saying instead of having Minsure run by a board that's, you know, somewhat independent, and frankly, I don't think it's accountable as it should be to both the legislature and the governor, let's just have that direct be an agency. So I don't see it as creating something different. I see that as just being run by someone different with more accountability. I think that in the long term, Mr. Chair, I mean, we are doing a lot of this work. There's no question about that. And and 90% moving forward of these enrollees, at least right now, are going to be public program enrollees. But I do want to make sure that we have a voice for the QHP enrollees as well, you know, and make sure we have some of that expertise. And I think the question is how to best do that.
All right. Are there any other questions for the commissioner, the assistant commissioner, or any of the other folks with specific respect to Minsure before we kind of transition to the Minnesota Care piece and how they relate together? All right, seeing no other questions, Commissioner, perhaps it would be a good idea to just stay where you are, and because we're just going to transition to the other piece of this. And this is another area of savings in the House bill. That is obviously not in the Senate bill, and point of major difference, obviously. And as we look at caring for or providing health insurance for lower-income Minnesotans, one of the things that we have brought up is that Minnesota, before the expansion of Medicaid in Minnesota, had a program for people who had pre-existing conditions in MSHA. We had a program to provide health care for lower-income families with Minnesota Care. We had a program for single adults without children, GAMC. And Minnesota really did establish many of the goals of the ACA on a state basis with those programs and others, with some federal help and with cooperation. And in the rollout of the Medicaid expansion, we have dismantled our MSHA program. We have subsumed GAMC within the Medicaid program, taking that up to 133% of FPG. And we have expanded our Minnesota Care program from what it was, only a small percentage of the previously enrolled Minnesota Care enrollees are in the new program, which is from 133% to 200% of FPG, and then 200 to 400 in our healthcare exchange. And as I pointed out on the floor and in public forums many times, we're the only state in the country that does that. The ACA had as a policy decision expanding Medicaid up to a certain point, drawing a line, and then saying, if you are above 133 in the case, 134 and up, that you'd receive assistance in the form of cost sharing and tax benefits to be able to afford insurance for lower income families and middle income families, that they would be able to afford health insurance. Minnesota is the only state in the country to accept a BHP, and at the point of, I think, design, it was seen as an alternative to the QHPs, that people could have a public option or they could shop online for QHP. Minnesota made the policy determination to make that mandatory And that did several things. Number one, it took people from 133 to 200 out of the QHP market, which I think actually exacerbated some of the problems that Mr. Lights took over in missed goals and lower numbers of folks showing up to purchase those plans than actually than we anticipated. And moving forward, we have a policy decision that says that we have this BHP, the one of one in the country, and we also have a QHP on top of that. And what we are saying is, how much are we paying for that, and what are we getting for that as a policy decision? Our reimbursement level from the federal government is lower than what we had expected. In fact, it's a pretty bad deal. We had expected that that this group would be nearly funded by the federal subsidies plus the premiums. But in fact, less than 50% of the costs of that are being picked up from the federal government. And what I've described it as is we've kind of ordered a Tesla and we are getting reimbursed at a Yugo, and we've got to make up the difference. And that is not a sustainable position, and in fact it has drained our the healthcare access fund. In the first committee hearing that we had was about the solvency of the healthcare access fund and the long-term sustainabilities that we have within that. That is why the House said that in order for us to move forward, we've got two plans right now that are a little shaky. The BHP, which we have is being nourished from the health care tax, which is scheduled to sunset, and we have a reimbursement rate, which is not sufficient for that to be sustainable on the one hand. And on the other hand, we have a MNsure product, which we just heard we are very, very concerned about the long-term solvency of that. We are maxed out at our withhold currently, and we don't have very much room to grow. Federal government said this is kind of the last check we're going to write. So that's why the House is very, very concerned about this moving forward. And we put an idea on the table that said we have one plan, we're very concerned about the solvency. We have another plan that revenue source is drying up and it will be gone in 2 years. We should combine them into one plan that works. That's the plan that the House put on the table for moving forward as a policy proposal. The governor, I think, has said that you may agree with some of those suppositions of that, and you can speak for the governor. But just in terms of a vision for how we're going to actually pay for this group of people, from specifically from 133 to 200, we have strong concerns. We also have strong concerns about actually expanding the BHP within the current legislation up to 275. And in fact, beyond that to 400 as an option for moving forward. We have that in our legislation currently that can happen. The House provision puts that in a repealer and says that we can't. So that's an introduction to kind of why the House bill looks like it does, and looking for a sustainable program for lower income Minnesotans and their families to obtain health insurance that they can depend on for themselves and their families moving forward. So, Commissioner, I don't know if you have had an opportunity to talk with the governor about that or about the proposals moving forward or just what the position is of the administration with where we are today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, kind of address some of the things you raised and then just talk a bit about kind of our perspective, the governor's and my perspective on this. You know, I think you're right. Minnesota was so far ahead of the Affordable Care Act in many ways. And there's a lot in the Affordable Care Act that was really drawing upon our experience in Minnesota. We were ahead of other states. And I think the fact that we're the only state to really try and add additional help for low-income adults through our Minnesota Care program and the BHP is just once again Minnesota being really out ahead in, when it comes to health care and support for vulnerable citizens. So from my perspective, I see that as a very good thing. If we're an outlier, we're an outlier ahead. A couple of things, you know, on the choice of it being mandatory, if you're going to do a BHP, the federal law says, then you don't have a choice to do BHP or a QHP. So that, that was, you know, just when the legislature made the choice to have BHP funding for Minnesota Care, you know, that was part of the federal guidance. But it's not, I would say, that our enrollees in Minnesota Care will not have choices. They will have choices of very good health plans. We run this through our managed care plans. But let me say a few things about kind of just where we are financially with funding for our Minnesota Care program. We do have a viable plan, you know, through the healthcare access funding, you know, through this next and the following biennium. But you're absolutely right, Mr. Chair. With the sunset provider tax starting in 2019, that is something that we have to address. We did end up with lower federal reimbursement. I think our projected reimbursement from the federal government was we thought it would cover with our premiums. I think it was 85% of the cost, and you're right, it's a little less than 50% now. And that is a lot of that has to do with the fact that we have some of the lowest rates in the country since how much we get paid on this BHP funding. It's tied to the rates because we get 95% of what the feds would otherwise add in kind of premium and cost-sharing assistance for this population. And the federal government is not having to pay as much to us as we anticipated because our rates are so much lower, which, of course, is a good thing overall for Minnesota. I do agree that we need to, over the long term, look at the sustainability of this program. And I say that because I think it is a very important program. That, you know, the policy decision to say that these low-income adults are better served in Minnesota Care with that benefit set and with more financial support, that that's the right policy decision. And that is really important for low-income Minnesotans, who I think many of us otherwise thought they could go into the exchange, and because these are folks that are living paycheck to paycheck just barely, what choice would they make? They would probably end up in one of the high-deductible plans, which would lead to a lot more medical, when they did have medical problems, more medical debt for them, more uncompensated care for providers. I think that was the reason we had so many in our provider and plan and healthcare community say we need to retain Minnesota Care. And we have a better support on our mental health system for people in Minnesota Care with our model mental health benefit set. And this is a population that really needs those extra supports. But I think it is right to say, financially, what should we be looking at? And the governor understands that. And I think that's one of the reasons his proposal is that we should do this through a bipartisan task force. Now, maybe there's a different way you want to look at this task force. Senator Hayden, I know, is also looking at a task force to look at things broader. But I think both of these programs can really benefit from that long-term look that I think Senator Rosen was talking about when it came to MNsure. But I think I do not think we should rush to solve a problem until we know more information. We don't have to rush to solve this problem. It's a problem in 2019. And here's some information just in the next year I think will be really helpful for us as we look at our Minnesota Care, the financing of our Minnesota Care program. For one thing, we're going to know what the rates are. You know, and as you all know, because you're such experts in this, there's a lot of volatility in our healthcare system today. With all of these new insurance mandates that went into effect in 2014, new populations that came in that hadn't been in the system before, there are a lot of ups and downs. We saw that, you know, with Preferred One and all last year. So I think we'll know what the rates are. And remember, since how much we get paid from the feds is tied to those rates, that's important. We're also going to know more about enrollment. Enrollment is actually in our Minnesota Care program. It's below our projections. And now, overall, if you look at our public programs overall, they are within 1% of what our projections and our forecasts were for enrollment. But it's higher in some parts, adults without kids and MA, lower in Minnesota Care. And so we need to see where that evens out, and it's something we're following closely because that helps say what is that financial gap. Another piece we'll know more about is a result of our competitive bidding process that we were talking about yesterday. So we put out all of our managed care contracts for Minnesota Care out for competitive bid. And partly we looked and said, a lot of volatility, a lot of new enrollees, and we thought, at some of the prices in the on the exchange, these lower premiums. So we want to see if we can get savings. Once again, another piece of information that we can have to say, and from my perspective, what we should be saying in the governor's perspective, Minnesota Care is a valuable program. We need to help this population, but we also need to examine what's the best financial way to do that, and we're going to have a lot more of those pieces of information to make that longer-term decision. And I think it really does fit with the options we have going forward with MNsure, and that looking at those and also just how we can improve our payment reform and our care delivery system that serves our healthcare system and so many of our public program enrollees overall at the same time. So I think that, I think with that I'll perhaps end, and happy to talk more about it, though. If there's something I missed, I'm sure you all will let me know.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just if I could have an opportunity to kind of frame up the difference that we have. You spelled out how we're the only state. I say we're the first state. And Minnesota's used to being the first state to do the new things that actually work to help people and communities be healthy. And we get great dividends from that. We are amongst the healthiest states in the country over and over and over again. And it's something that we're very proud of. And it stems from a willingness to invest in the health of our people and the health of our communities. Again, we get great dividends from that. Our businesses get great dividends. Our families, our people do better when we all understand that access to quality, affordable health care is something that we as a people value and value with an investment. So Minnesota is unique and has been for a very long time. And as we roll out into a federal reform that we were required to comply with, to just take straight up Obamacare, which is what Representative Dean's plan is. It is Obamacare. It's a federal exchange. It's just the QHPs that are there for people. It's the federal one-size-fits-all model, superimposing it on Minnesota. That moves us backwards from where we've always been in making sure that our people have the coverage that's right for themselves and their families. And that was one of the things that was very important to us in attempting to comply with federal reforms, is that Minnesota uses it as an opportunity to move forward and improve the health of our people. And it is consistent with that long-term commitment to invest. To the point, Representative Dean, that you're proposing that we move to one plan that works, I mean, I guess whether or not that works is certainly something that's questionable. It's one that many have questioned. I mean, I think that the great likelihood would be that this would create a great deal of havoc in these 100,000 Minnesotans that rely on Minnesota Care. It would create a great deal of havoc in their lives to lose this care and to have to go and try to find an alternative source of health care that would have higher premiums, higher copays, higher deductibles, not have the model mental health benefit set that helps so many of them, have so many of the better options that they have available within Minnesota Care that have helped them for so long. And, you know, just about every single group within our healthcare industry and within our provider groups and our consumer advocacies have written letters saying this is not the time to end Minnesota Care. It would throw us into too much turmoil in the haphazard manner that the House has proposed. We have a letter from the Minnesota Medical Association oppose the House proposal to repeal Minnesota Care. We have a sign-on letter with 83 organizations with large constituencies all across the state of Minnesota. Members got this, the Safety Net Coalition, the Minnesota Hospital Association, community health centers, you know, the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. These are the people who pay the provider tax, by the way, that supports Minnesota Care, and we have a balanced health care access fund that supports this longstanding investment that we've had for the 4 years of our budget cycle. And if we want to talk about the desire to protect the Health and Human Services budget moving forward, I think we should have a good conversation about that, because in your proposal to repeal Minnesota Care, you take the quote-unquote savings and you dump them in to the general fund in a manner that provides for one-time money. This money ends, as you stated yourself, and you put it into one-time money and spend it on ongoing obligations that the state of Minnesota will have to live up to. Now, I went and tallied those up, and it's on line 777 of the spreadsheet. Anyone who wants to look at it, it's $632 million in 2016-17 and $751 million of one-time money spent on ongoing needs in 18-19. In the next biennium that you're so worried about the sustainability of, you have absolutely no way to cover those costs. You've spent it on ongoing supports for elderly and disabled that I think are really, and mental health, that I think are really valuable investments. But you've made those investments in and commitments in ongoing needs that we're going to have with one-time money. It is absolutely irresponsible budgeting in the name of trying to provide for a plan that is sustainable, and you've missed the mark on all fronts.
Well, Senator Lurie, I would just point out that that the costs, and I guess we could go into the costs of Minnesota Care on a per family basis, of how those are covered, are not covered in the future. And in fact, the Health Care Access Fund is taken down to zero. In the last biennium, you know, you could have extended the provider tax and, in fact, increased it or modified it, but you chose not to, but yet built a plan that, in fact, is a continuing obligation and growing obligation into the future with no way to pay for that. The provider tax does sunset. That does go away. And, in fact, what the plan does is it migrates the budget directly into the general fund and forecasts it. So if you are a committee chair for health and human services, but for K-12 or higher ed, you should be very concerned about that, because we are dumping that future obligation of a one state entitlement onto the general fund as a forever policy decision that we're doing. So that's what your bill does. Whether or not that's a good policy decision is up to us, but that's a discussion that we can have, but certainly we cannot do that without acknowledging the fact that, in fact, we don't pick that up in the costs moving forward. Representative Zerwas.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the commissioner. What is the total cost per family, or if you have it per individual, what is the total cost per month for one of these policies through Minnesota Care?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, I have with me kind of the premium cost for families, but I think if you mean the cost the state pays for our capitation payments to the health plans, just so that I understand what your question is, or the total, I can also give you the total cost of the program.
Representative Zeros.
I think we're looking at for like an average monthly cost for the enrollee, a premium cost.
Depends on their income. Depends on their income.
Yeah, well,
I know. Mr. Chair, can I? I'm trying to understand your question, Representative. Is it what you think the state pays, or is it what the family pays?
I want to see the whole picture.
The whole
picture. What we get from the feds, what we get from the state, what that family share is.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, I'm told that it is, the cost is $523 on average, kind of the per member per month cost.
Representative Zerwas.
So help me figure this one out then. Full disclosure, I barely passed my math portion in college. I'm not a math guy. Biology major, boy, that math was tough. So if it's $523 a month for 100,000 people is what we're saying. So that's around $500 million. Why do we budget $1.4 billion in a biennium, and then the state only pays half of that? So why are we so far off?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas. The overall cost for the state for like 2014, to give you an example, is about $520 million. Then of that cost, so that kind of, if you double that, you know, you get to kind of around kind of the billion. For that was this the total cost of Minnesota Care. So of that, if you look at state cost, $247 million, so about $250 million came from the state. About that same amount came from the federal government, just a little about $4 million less. And then we also had $31 million because there are premiums, you know, and in this program. Does that help you kind of understand the overall costs?
So what's the, Mr. Chair?
Representative Zerwas.
I think the point I'm trying to get to eventually here, give me time, is what's the gap then overall per enrollee as far as what we pay on a state portion versus what we get reimbursed. What's that gap?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, I don't think of it as a gap. I think of it as just how much do we pay, how much do the feds pay, how much do the enrollees pay. And I think what the chair was referring to earlier was that we're not getting the federal reimbursement as much as we anticipated. And that was, as what I tried to explain, is that's because the rates were lower. And what the feds paid to us for this program under the basic health plan funding, instead of like MA, where usually the feds pay half, that's a percentage, these payments are tied to what they'd otherwise pay to support this population in the exchange. And so that's why it really varies. And so in a year where premiums are low, they don't, you know, then they don't pay as much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
So earlier you had mentioned that we had to wait because of the volatility, and there was a chance that our reimbursement rate could go up. And you kind of talked about the volatility, and so you were kind of hopeful that there's an opportunity that reimbursement might go up. But in order for that reimbursement to go up, wouldn't that mean that all of the premiums within the exchange would then go up to pull up that average? Because you were talking earlier about that there was an opportunity, perhaps, that the reimbursement would increase this next year. And so, in my understanding, in order for that to occur, we're based off of, I think it's the silver plan or the bronze. So that average price would have to go up for our reimbursement level to go up. Am I following that right or not?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, I want to be really clear. I did not say I was hopeful rates would go up. That is
I'm at our reimbursement rate from the feds.
What I
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas. What I was trying to say was there are three things that I know of that will inform us in figuring out the finance, long-term financing for this program that are going to happen over the, that we'll know more a year from now. And one of them, one of those things we'll know more about is what the rates are. I wasn't hoping that the rates would go up because I try and think about Minnesota generally, not just about people on one program. And then there were a couple of other things where I was just pointing out that we will know more about this.
Okay, that's helpful.
Senator Lurie.
So, I mean, I think one of the things, again, that I'm just going to have to return to that's important to remember is that we do have a balanced budget for sustaining Minnesota Care over the 4 years of our budget projections. At the end of that time, yes, the provider tax goes away. But there isn't this big rush to, in the next couple of weeks, try to dismantle something that has been so valuable. And that's what these letters are saying. At the end of 2019, you know, more than 4 years out, the Health Care Access Fund is in balance. It has a zero balance. It's not negative. It's not positive. It is in balance for 4 years. This is a spending level that is commensurate with what we've invested in this population and in this model of care for over 20 years. There isn't a need to rush to dismantle this over the next couple of weeks and throw consumers that rely on Minnesota Care and the healthcare industry that serves these individuals into chaos. We can maintain this. Things are going to be okay. We can agree to have a task force over the interim and begin to look at sustainability issues and financing issues as we move forward and have additional opportunities to look at things. And at a time when we have a Republican-controlled House and a DFL-controlled Senate, it's a good time to make sure that every voice is at the table and talking about where we should be going. But in the next, well, actually not a couple of weeks, I don't know, what is it, 10 days, 9 days now? I think it would be a great disservice to all of those that count on Minnesota Care. And I have the backing of almost everyone in our healthcare industry saying this is not a well-conceived plan.
Senator Hayden. Oh, sorry.
Just real briefly, I guess I want to be sure.
Representative, you said Senator Hayden. So I'll defer. I just wanted to make sure, because I think sometimes, Representative Zerwoff, you didn't hear what the chair said. I just want to make sure. I'll defer to you, but you did say Senator Hayden, Mr. Chair.
I'll let Representative Zerwas have the last word.
Absolutely.
I absolutely.
I just wanted to make sure we were following the chair's rules,
that you'll be in the unfortunate position of having Representative Zerwas talk after you.
Absolutely. Well, I was just going to say, I just wanted to make sure we, in the Senate, I have learned we anyways. So I was really just kind of trying to build off of Representative Zerwas's kind of line of questioning, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, as there was this kind of assertion of, well, if health care costs go up, then we get reimbursed more, and that might be a good thing. And you were clear to say that that's not what your wish was. But, Commissioner, we do know that for whatever reason, we know that, for instance, Preferred One came in very low. And that helped to drive healthcare costs down. But then they came back the next year and they said, well, we really can't sustain this. And we gotta kind of raise those up to cover the cost. And so they had this conversation with Commerce and others and whoever sets those rates and ultimately decided not to get back into the exchange. And my sense is that because they realized that the rates that they had offered were too low for them to be able to make a go of it. But that also had some ramifications in driving costs down, which then has a nexus to what we get from the federal government. So I just want to make sure, and if I'm wrong, Commissioner or Representative Dean, Senator Lurie, those that know this a lot better than me, but that kind of created an imbalance in the volatility that I think that you are a part of the volatility that you're talking about in the system. And Senator Lurie, as he talks about getting together, we're balanced. Let's take a look at what we need to do as we kind of right size and this normalizes how this process, this very new process of the ACA is going to work. then we can actually see what does it cost to cover all of these populations and ensure that just somebody in the marketplace who kind of rolled the dice on essentially low rates and then found out, wow, that doesn't really work for me, that they, I don't know if any of us thought or knew, or, and maybe we did, healthcare economists or others didn't know what the ramifications are. But since that process has normalized a little bit and the plans and others that are here have started to recognize the rules of the ACA and what it costs to cover, I think it would be wise for us to, one, understand that, and Commissioner, I'm looking at you if I'm wrong, but also then take a little bit more time to figure out what should we do and how should we do it. So I don't think it'd be anyone surprised that I support the Senate's position on this, obviously, and the rationale that Senator Lori gives about moving forward. But I do think that as we start to try to find out what happened, we need to really understand what were the forces that were involved that created some of the situations that we have today. Now, Commissioner, if you can expound on that or add, I'd love it. I'm a little bit of a novice at this, and I'm just trying to understand how this works.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, overall, Senator Hayden, I think I agree with your overall take on this, and I don't think all the volatility necessarily is behind us. And that's why I think that given that we can pay for this program through the Health Care Access Fund for this next two bienniums, that it really behooves us to take a careful look at this as we get more information and know more and are more thoughtful about it.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Ross.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. First, my apologies to the Senator.
That's okay.
He looked at me and talked to you, so I apologize. But just for just a quick comment for in response to what Chair Lori was saying about making a rush, you know, to this and having this discussion over the course of a week, I want to be pretty clear about the Senate's the House's role this session and our discussion was ongoing. I think our first hearing had to do with the issues and the shortfall in the Health Care Access Fund, which led to numerous hearings and discussions within the House about the long-term sustainability of this program and look at that. So the idea that this is a new topic or that this is something that we've decided to bring up and discuss in a week, I think, isn't very genuine. We've been talking about it for months. It's certainly been on our radar since the forecast and since the transfer in the last budget period. Of course, there's a concern that if enrollment projections, if enrollment exceeds expectations within this group, that there will again be a shortfall, as in previous years. So I think this this idea that this is a new topic and we're going to hash out what public programs look like over the course of the next few days, to be clear, and a little bit to our chair's credit, we've been having these discussions for months.
If I could just correct the record, it has been said over and over and over again that there's a shortfall, and there's not. The Health Care Access Fund is balanced. There isn't a shortfall. So I just need to correct that for the record.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. That may be one of the things that adds to our confusion is the belief that there's a shortfall and our belief that there is not a shortfall for the next two bienniums, which gives us time for the conversations we need to have. So that may be a difference. We don't see it as a shortfall when the budget is balanced for the next two bienniums. But the other component I was talking about, which is the volatility issue that you've raised also, that we've that plays in this is the problem in the beginning of the change because of the Affordable Care Act's not allowing insurance companies to refuse anybody because of prior existing conditions, and that the state of Minnesota had developed, among other programs, to care for people in its state, a special program for those who could not get insurance in the private marketplace called MJ. And that was a very high risk pool of people. They had high premiums in order to participate in it. But it was our way of taking those that the private industry had peeled off and abandoned and tried to provide some way of giving them some health insurance coverage. So when that went away, and when the ability of an insurance company or a provider of a product could no longer restrict their risk pool by on the basis of past health problems, we were very concerned about how they were going to be integrated into this system. So when the company offered a low-cost policy on the exchange, there was, and they took a huge number of the people that enrolled there, we're talking about this very high-risk pool of MCHA. We don't hear us talking about that. Who entered that? Who was that group of people that became a part of this product for Preferred One? And why couldn't they afford it? In part because it wasn't anticipated in the pricing. That the risk pool that they would have would be so expensive. In the bills that you get to pay for the care of the people that are in your pool are what you bring to the Department of Commerce when you go for adjusting your rates. And that was a significant component of what was happening in the first year. We were integrating, trying to figure out what to do with this very high-risk pool under the new law of the Affordable Care Act. And that's now sort of been integrated somewhere in the system pretty much. I want you to confirm that, Commissioner, or at least speak to how this factor is playing into the volatility issue.
Good point.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I will share my understanding. Obviously, MCHA and the whole transfer of MCHA is under the Department of Commerce. So this is really, in some ways, as more of a kind of bystander, but who's obviously very interested in this. I think that certainly the integration of MCHA was part of how that played out was part of this volatility. My understanding is that more people migrated to the exchange, or they migrated more quickly than was anticipated. And then that was part of what was, driving some of these concerns. But I think my knowledge a lot beyond that is
fair enough.
Limited.
Fair enough.
Thank you, Senator. And I think just, with regard to the solvency of the Healthcare Access Fund, it's something that obviously we pay close attention to. In the last biennium, we had, as current law, when the balance in the Healthcare Access Fund reached a certain point, the sick tax would be reduced in 0.5% bites. Because of the transfer from the Healthcare Access Fund to the General Fund, enough money was swept into the General Fund to prohibit or to cut off that tax decrease. That would have happened had the money been able to stay in the Healthcare Access Fund, which was the intent, where the federal, the message was that the federal government's going to come in, Minnesota, good job, step aside, we got this, and we're going to take care of this problem for you from now on. And the anticipation was at that time, and the reason that the governor signed the legislation was that the federal government was going to take care of this issue and we wouldn't have to pay for it anymore. It sounded like a good deal to a lot of people. It sounded like a good deal to the hospitals. It sounded like a good deal to the doctors. It sounded like a good deal to the providers that the federal government was going to come in and take this obligation away from us. So that's why a lot of people were very excited about that that happening, when in fact what we see now is that we are baking those costs into our future forecasts. So that's why the solvency of this comes into question, that number one, the 2% provider tax is going to go away. We know that. By transferring this to the general fund, we are obligating that as a future and ongoing expenditure in the general fund. There is no provider tax that will fund that. That means that will come from the general fund, and it will compete with higher ed, it will compete with K-12, and it will compete with other competing things. So you are baking in a tax increase in the next when this completes itself. This is very much like taking home a polar bear cub. That's what we're doing here, and it's going to grow. And we're going to have to deal with this in the future biennium. The next governor coming in will not be very appreciative of the fact that this is going to be in the first weeks of the budget coming in, that this will be on the tab. So I just want people to understand that that's the policy decision that is being made in the Senate provisions to transfer this to the general fund to keep the ongoing obligations and to eliminate the revenue source moving forward. So that's why our concern. That's why if you were to get in the time machine and go up to the 2019 January when people are putting together a budget, people are going to remember this conference committee. I will guarantee it if we go down that road. So that's why we're talking about this, and I think it's important to do so at this time. And I do want to pivot towards kind of moving forward and what the vision is in a couple of different pieces. But we also had a couple of questions from Senator Sharon, Senator Hayden, and Senator Lori.
Thank you. I forgot my question, so you can just pass over me.
You'll think of it.
Well, yes.
And I'll be brief because I know that the time is waning up, Mr. Chair, but I always like to listen to what you say. And you said this kind of in the last couple of days on this frame of, like, what Minnesotans care most about. So you said this in kind of your opening statements, like, well, higher ed or K-12 or HHS and this kind of transfer. And so somehow somebody must think that K-12 is more important or higher ed is more important than helping people who get help out of this budget. Low-income people who need health care, seniors, people with disabilities, et cetera, right? And I just want to make sure that we don't kind of start what I often call is a race to the bottom around here, where all of a sudden we just start playing these budget divisions and Minnesota's values against each other. I just think that that's really important, and I've heard that. I've heard you say it, and that could be your value system, and I respect that. I care about K-12. I care about our kids going to college, but I also care about the vulnerable people that are in this budget here today. And I want us to find solutions that hopefully get us a race to the top and not in the education world, that language, but the idea that we're moving forward and that we're not kind of continuing to kind of pit each of these divisions or the people who care about this. Minnesotans are holistic. They're a person. They care about all of these issues. They care about their hospital stays. They care about vulnerable people on the street. They care about their seniors. They care about their kids. They care about their kids' education. And so I just would hope that we would continue to talk about that. I do think that the idea that Senator Lori continues to say that the budget period that we're looking at, we're in balance. I'll say it again. We are in balance, and we do have time to put together a bipartisan task force. I have a bill on it. The governor has a proposal on it that will invite all of the important people in this room and at this table to really talk about what's the best way to go. And we don't. It is not an emergency in the context in which you say it. I just think that that's important to say because I've heard you kind of talk about this in relationship to higher ed and to K-12, and I think that this is equally as important, the budget that we are dealing with today.
Senator Lori.
So, you know, Representative Dean, I heard your deep frustration that a contingent tax cut didn't occur for the folks who pay our provider tax, and that they were looking forward to that, and it didn't happen, and they didn't get the deal they were looking for. And yet, I have letters from almost everyone who pays the provider tax that says the best deal we got going for right now is to continue MinnesotaCare and have a discussion moving into the interim about the long-term financing of health care. Now, in the Senate's plan, continuing MinnesotaCare and having a discussion about how we manage long-term with the financing, I would argue is a far superior long-term budget view than what the House does. The House eliminates MinnesotaCare and creates a $1,162,000,000 hole in the 2020 budget that we don't see on this sheet yet. You use this one-time savings and dump it into the general fund and spend it on ongoing needs without a discussion about the long-term sustainability of it. That's what's going to hit higher ed. That's what's going to hit K-12. That's what's going to hit all of our other budgets, is the $1,162,000,000 hole that you guys are creating in the House bill by using one-time money for ongoing needs to care for seniors, disabled, children in need of protection, you know, really critical needs. But you're using fake money and creating a hole by using one-time money that comes in from the provider tax. I think that the Senate's proposal to continue MinnesotaCare, have a discussion about how we move forward and make sure that we have a plan for the right investment and the right health care for Minnesotan to make sure that we are able to maintain our position as the healthiest state in the country, is far superior and far more protective of all of the other budgets that you purport to be worried about.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to start by thanking for whomever passed out the letters for the MinnesotaCare and what they provide here. It was interesting to me that these are the people who do pay the provider tax, yet they are, except for the Minnesota Medical Association, the Hospital Association, silent on the fact that there is a provider tax that covers MinnesotaCare. They don't advocate for it, reinstating the sunset. They don't take a position at all on the House position of accelerating the sunset of that. And it's just kind of interesting to me that they do stay silent on some issues while making points on the other issues, the benefits of what they have there. But I had a question for the commissioner, and this will probably be the last time I speak today because it's been twice now. That's too much for me. But
we'll give you a waiver.
I'm wondering if, Commissioner, you have numbers, if you could get me numbers at some point if you don't have them available right now. But just with the people who enrolled through MinSure over the last since inception that were directed towards MinnesotaCare from that based on their applications, if you have that number and just what of that the 90 or 100,000 enrollees we have today, just how much of that came through their direction through MinSure.
Commissioner Justin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumacher, well, let me share with you the information I do have, and if that's not sufficient, then we can go back and get you more information. So the average monthly enrollees, the last number I had, was 94,973. You know, it's obviously kind of there's rolling enrollment. We had about 100,000 average monthly enrollees in fiscal year 2014. But the so that's kind of the number. And the MinnesotaCare, all of our enrollees in MinnesotaCare now are in the MinSure IT system. So as I think Representative Mack was referencing yesterday, we have a number of our medical assistants enrollees that are about, you know, a little over 400,000 that are still in our legacy systems. And as an aside, we're not converting, we call it, but transferring, sending them over to MinSure until we get some of these life event and other things fixed. But all of our MinnesotaCare enrollees now are in the MinSure system. Either they came into it or they were on a separate legacy system where we converted them and, you know, moved them into the MinSure system because we weren't able, in that the old system they were on, to do the renewals and eligibility checks that we needed to, you know, so we needed to make sure that they were continuing to be eligible, so we transferred them. Does that answer your question?
Representative Schumacher.
For today, yes, but if I come up with a better question, I'll follow up with you later. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I was wondering if you, it's been a while, like 4 months, since we've heard about the governor's proposal for Minnesota Care, if you could go through his initial proposal, and apparently there's another proposal that's on the table. Is that correct?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen. So in the governor's original budget, there was, at that point, there was a deficit in the health care access fund, or projected as a result of the November forecast. So the governor originally proposed a slight increase to premiums for people in Minnesota Care who are over 150% of the poverty level, and some additional cost sharing, just basically to make sure that we didn't have a deficit. When we got the February forecast, a couple of things happened. We had new enrollment numbers, lower than projected, kind of I referred to before. But we also, we had been making this argument to the federal government that they ought to let us do Minnesota risk adjustment and not have to follow kind of their federal approach. They approved that. That resulted in additional dollars so that we didn't have a I think there may be in some small things as well, but those are the two big ones. So we didn't have a deficit in the healthcare access fund. So when the governor made his supplemental budget, he made it clear that he didn't want to increase premiums or cost sharing in our Minnesota Care program.
Thank you. And Commissioner, this is probably a good time just to go to the 2017 Innovation Waiver Progress Report, because I think this kind of highlights a little bit of where I see things going. And if you go to page 9, the last two paragraphs, it talks about federal waivers and creating a seamless integration of our programs. And it says federal waivers could be used to create a more unified and seamless continuum of coverage for Minnesotans from 0 to 400% of FPG. That is a kind of an interesting proposal and an idea. Is that kind of what the governor sees moving forward, to kind of, instead of getting rid of our DHP, to kind of get rid of the healthcare exchange and put everybody on sort of one sliding program of the federal government?
Mr. Chair, could I step back just and explain what this waiver opportunity is?
That'd be great.
Would that be okay?
Yep.
Okay.
Give us an update.
So as part of the Affordable Care Act, the federal government said that states can come in starting in, I think it is, 2017, and it's called an innovation waiver, that states can come in and say to the federal government, we want to be able to design our own health care system for people that are served through the exchange. And it's very clear that you can do that kind of with a Medicaid waiver as well, what we call our 1115 waivers. You can use both of that, and as long as the states have to show that under their system they would still cover people would, just the same people would get covered with just as good coverage. So it's not a way to back away from coverage for people, but that they could really design their own system and ask for basically all the dollars the federal government is paying through the exchange, and on the Medicaid side ask for some of those Medicaid dollars. So it's an opportunity to really let states be much more in the driver's seat. I think what the Affordable Care Act did in some ways is there are parts of it that are one size fits all, and it lets states say, we want to do this differently. I think there are I've gotten a lot of interest for people who are interested in saying, we'd like the chance to design what this would look like for Minnesota, looking across the Medicaid, Minnesota Care, people who are getting assistance through QHPs, and couldn't we do that better if we design that ourselves? Now some people would say, we want to design that system for much more market-based. I remember talking with people at the Chamber of Commerce who were like, we're really interested in this. We think we ought to look at this. We'd take a market-based approach. Others would say, well, let's just put everyone in a single system. You know, I think one of the things the governor wants to ask this task force to look at is, should we be, as a state, asking for an innovation waiver? But if we're going to ask, we need to be able to say what it would look like. So I think the governor's position is, we should come together, on a bipartisan basis and look at this opportunity. And that's why, and that's one of the things that in his letter about the task force, he made clear he would want the task force to look at. And what role would Minnesota Care or MinSure, you know, or public programs play in that? You know, our report was really just trying to, in part of the paragraphs you're saying, of the opportunities you could have to not have the cliffs between programs that we have now, where people kind of, you know, from going from Medicaid to Minnesota Care even, or Minnesota Care suddenly to the QHPs, that there be an opportunity to smooth that out so it's more seamless for people. Now, how you do that, you could do that, as I said, you could do that through tax credits. You could do that through having one single government program and a lot of things in between. And I think from the governor's perspective, he thinks we ought to be coming together to look at that.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I think that, you know, we're obviously very interested in that. And it was, we had a very similar proposal in 2011, as I recall, but it kind of came at it from a little bit of a different perspective, I think. And for those of us that are looking at the BHP going from 200 to 275 and the potential of expanding that up to 400, I think would be very costly. And also, I just kind of look at it from my own perspective of a guy with three kids, and currently I would be in the BHP up to about $56,500 if I doubled that to $113,000 a year. It seems incredibly inappropriate for me to be accessing that program. For example, for if I were to access the emergency room and to have a total out of cost for let's say the sniffles, and I were to access the emergency room, to have total out of cost for myself of less than $5. That seems a little bit out of whack for, and probably not a very good use of our state or federal resources for that. It seems like a bad fit for the person to the program. So that's why many of us get very anxious about the expansion of the BHP currently from 200 to 275. And I think that the folks in the hospitals that have lower reimbursement rates and the physicians that have lower reimbursement rates should worry about that, as well as expanding that further. And so that's why we're worried. And Senator Hayden, that's not a concern about a race to the bottom. You know, that's a concern about, you know, it, being able to afford the programs that we have and have insurance policies that are accessible to middle-class families. And a lot of people have, when the 2% sick tax came in, providers didn't like it, but the thing that was always there was kind of the chain link fence around it with the barbed wire on top that was supposed to keep that contained to the health care policies. And when that rule was violated, people got very upset about it, and a little bit or a lot. That was the fact. So when you take that away and you forecast it into the general fund and the 2% tax goes into the general fund, that's what people are worried about. And that's why when folks are talking about moving the gas tax revenue from dedicated funds to the general fund, people get pretty concerned about that from your side of the aisle, and with good reason, I think, in many cases. So it's not so much a race to the bottom, it's a race to the money that I'm more concerned about as we look forward to the future of that. But that's kind of where I was looking at, is if this is the governor's vision for going forward, I think then we're probably more concerned about it. Than less concerned about it. I know that there's talk about a commission and a plan, bipartisan commission, to kind of look at this and to see what's going on with MinSure. And I can tell you that it's not a rush or that I think you hear from the House plan. I think it's an acknowledgement of our constituents who are telling us that they're fed up with MinSure and the missed deadlines, and they're fed up with the consumer experience, as well as in our private plans, the unbelievable expansion from the 2 to 50 small group and individual insurance plans that we've seen across the state. So the warning lights are really on for middle-class Minnesota already. So that's where if you hear people who are in haste to try to get some resolution, the families that are struggling under this really don't want a task force to hear about. They want some results, and I think that's what you're hearing and seeing from the House side. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Hayden.
Well, I'll be brief as I know Senator Lori wants to kind of wrap up. I just want to also just continue to caution us that this, even when I read the task force and the innovation saying going up to 400, well, the QHP, the exchange, goes there. I mean, just depending on where you are, who you are, what your situation is. I mean, Representative Dean, you would probably not be the right example because you have health insurance. And so you wouldn't be in the exchange because you get it through us. I mean, I'm just saying that just depends on who you are. So I just want to caution us in saying that, as Commissioner Jetson said, to take a look at this. It could be market-driven. It could be the single-payer, right, and everything in between is an opportunity for us to be creative and innovative and take a look at it. And so I just always want to make sure that, you know, I'm kind of a glass half full guy, and I'm an optimist, as you guys know, around here as I smile. And I think that there's real opportunity for us to take a look at it. And I don't – I pick up on trends. You also said baked in. You continue to say something is baked in, Mr. Chair, and I don't see it that way. I don't see that this is baked in yet. I see that there still is an opportunity. Senator Rosen and I were talking about kind of getting to it. Like she came up with a third way for Minshew today. I wish we would have spent a little more time examining that. We've talked about it. But, like, let's really start to get to it and figure it out. And I don't necessarily think that this is scary. I think that this is an opportunity for us to have the conversation. And I hope that we would do it. But anecdotally, I just would caution us from kind of coming up with the worst-case scenario and say that that's what's going to happen. And I know, Mr. Chair, that's not what you were doing, but I just wanted to make sure that those that are listening, because it's a lot of them, because my phone continues to get to buzz, that we understand that we're having this conversation, but we're trying to do it in the best and most appropriate way. And I don't think that the worst-case scenario is going to happen. I think that we anticipated a certain process when we kind of got into this and the provider tax. Things have changed, things are fluid, so we're going to now kind of react to the market conditions, hopefully have a conversation with all the stakeholders, and then figure out what do we do in the future. But I will say, still a little bit of Senator Lori's thunder, is that we're in balance through the budget responsibilities that we have in this committee.
Four years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lori?
Representative Dean, you know, I mean, I guess it's an interesting story you tell about you and your family going to the ER for the sniffles, but I think it does a little bit of disrespect for some of the really low-income Minnesotans who are served by our public programs to compare your life and your story to those that people struggle with. And, you know, I mean, for Minnesota Care, a single individual is making less than $12 an hour. And, you know, the security that Minnesota Care provides and the better coverage with the model mental health benefit set and the, you know, access to care that has worked for two decades is something that is really incredibly valuable to Minnesotans and shouldn't just be discarded quickly, should be done. And, you know, we should look at it in a thoughtful process and think about, you know, I understand part of the issue that you and I have discussed that you have is the unfairness, this issue that at 200%, there's quite a drastic change. It's a cliff. You know, I think that we should look at opportunities to address that and think how we serve populations all the way across the spectrum without presupposing what it's going to look like. I don't think it would or should look like your family being going to the ER with no copay for the sniffles. I don't think that would be good public policy either. We can agree at least on that. But we should take a look at it. And I think that, you know, one of the things people say, they look at this cliff and they say, you know what, That's unfair. So let's make life worse for poor people. Well, I say, all right, there's a cliff. It's an issue. Let's try to take a look at all of the populations that we serve. And make no mistake about it, above 200%, between 200 and 400%, that's a public program. QHP is tax credits to help people buy down their health insurance. It's another public program today. And we should take a look at the public programs and how they work and how we make it smooth across there so that we don't have these difficult points where there is a real difference across an income threshold, and try to smooth that out and make the right public policy to serve people across the entire income spectrum. And I don't think that's unreasonable. And, you know, again, I guess I won't go to the balanced budget for 4 years other than to just say that. I'll go once again to your plan, tearing it down, using the one-time savings generated and pouring it into long-term commitments to serve vulnerable populations, good investments, but serve them with one-time money creates a $1,162,000,000 hole in the 2020 biennium that you purport to be so worried about.
Well, I guess, I'm sorry. Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just briefly, I do think it's an important clarification for people to, you know, realize that with the concept and the theory of moving some of those qualifications to the 275, I'm afraid that what we would be doing is pushing the cliff out, making the cliff worse for people. I think other states have managed to create a way to make it a smoother transition for people if they go from the public programs to the private market, and kind of making that smoother. I think by moving up to 275, you exasperate the problem and you make that cliff worse and more dramatic for people to truly move up. And so I think that's something that as this conversation moves forward and as these conversations are had in the future, that's something that needs to be looked at. How are you making it easier for citizens to work their way up and out of needing government assistance? How are you making that possible? What tools are you giving them? And I think by just moving that number, you're not doing that. You're making the cliff worse and you're pushing it out. And so I think that's something that we should just be cognitive of. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to – just a clarification for the record again, if I could, and I'm going to quit at that then. It's been referred to as a plan or a proposal to do these things, and that is not what it is. It is a progress report. It is a list of the options available for us to consider. It is not a proposal. It is not a plan. It is not in the legislation in front of us. It is a list of what is options provided through the 1332 waiver in combination with the 1115 waivers that have existed for a long time. These are a list of options for us to consider. It is not a proposal, and that's just for the record. It has been stated many times, and we should be clear.
And I think it is important to be clear that the 275 is in current legislation, and our plan brings that back, and that just is. So, and we've got two, you know, I think one of the criticisms of the House plan is that it is contradictory, or it's trying to do two things or move in two directions at the same time. And I think from those of us that kind of look at it from the from a different branch on the tree, this is kind of contradictory, where we realize that people, low-income Minnesotans, can't go out on the market and buy market rate insurance and be able to afford that if they're low income, and that we agree that you need public, that it's in the public's best interest to help people buy insurance, and in fact for people who are disabled or very low income to provide that insurance through Medicaid. We decided that, and I think that's a good public policy decision. Some folks on my side of the aisle might disagree with that. That's fine, but I think we can agree with that. Where you're looking at an issue of drawing, so every other state in the country drew a line and said, up to here we're going to do Medicaid, and then we're going to help people buy private health care insurance for themselves and their families. We drew another line in there, and we said, well, there's this in-between group, and what does that look like? And it, as it turns out, it's much more expensive for the state of Minnesota than we thought it was going to be. Moving the Minnesota care population up from 133 to 200, we got a bad deal. And that's not Matt Dean saying that. That's, you know, Keith Ellison saying that. That's every member of our congressional delegation saying that. We got a bad deal. We did. So if we're looking at a public policy that actually expands that moving forward or preserves that or, in fact, moves that to the general fund, I think that's a public policy decision that is going to have great cost to Minnesotans and also remove the choice from that group. So in my family's case, again, up to $56,500 for my family, moving that up would go to, you know, $77,000 a year, where you'd have no choice, in fact, that you can't go to the market, the exchange, and shop like everybody else, like you could if we were to move across the river and, to God forbid, move to Wisconsin. So that's the kind of duality that we're looking at in a public policy that I think is a good public policy discussion in moving forward and what's the right way for Minnesota to go. And also, what are the costs? What are the cost differences, not just for ourselves moving forward, but if we do, in fact, general fund this and bake it into the future or saute it, Senator Hayden. Maybe we're not baking it. Maybe it's just in the big saucepan at this point. But moving it into the future, that has a policy ramification down the road. And maybe the analogy of bringing home a polar bear cub is it overstates it. But it is, in fact, future obligations to the general fund that we need to take responsibility for. So with that, that's about it for me today. Senator, and we're not going to meet tomorrow.
We're not going to meet tomorrow.
No meeting on Saturday, and no meeting on Sunday. Stay tuned for Monday. You'll have the gavel.
Will I have the gavel on Monday?
Yep.
I have the gavel tomorrow.
He has it Sunday, and you have it Monday.
He doesn't have it Sunday.
We'll figure it out.
He has it Monday. I think you have it on Monday. If I'm. I know I have it tomorrow.
Oh, okay. We'll stay tuned and we'll figure this out. And to each and every mother, happy Mother's Day. To everybody with a mom, happy Mother's Day.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend, everybody.
Weird. You celebrate.
Thank you. Mama.